on a small satin pillow which said New York World's Fair on one side. "Thought I'd make you a little nest, kid," she said. "Thanks," he said. It was a simple, almost offhand act of kindness, but Jack found himself having to struggle from bursting into tears. He managed to smile instead. "Thanks a lot, Lori." "No problem. You'll be all right here, Jack. Smokey ain't so bad. Once you get to know him, he ain't half bad." She said this with an unconscious wistfulness, as if wishing it were so. "Probably not," Jack said. And then he added impulsively, "But I'm moving on tomorrow. Oatley's just not for me, I guess." She said, "Maybe you'll go, Jack, and maybe you'll decide to stay a while. Why don't you sleep on it?" There was something forced and unnatural about this little speech. It had none of the genuineness of her grin when she'd said, "Thought I'd make you a little nest." Jack noticed it, but was too tired to do more than that. "Well, we'll see," he said. "Sure we will," Lori agreed, going to the door. She blew a kiss toward him from the palm of one dirty hand. "Good night, Jack."
"Good night."
He started to pull off his shirt, and then left it on, deciding he would just take off his sneakers. The storeroom was cold and chilly. He sat down on the apple sacks, pulled the knots, pushed off first one and then the other. He was about to lie back on Lori's New York World's Fair souvenir, and he might well have been sound asleep before his head ever touched it, when the telephone began to ring out in the bar, shrilling into the silence, drilling into it, making him think of wavering, pasty gray roots and bullwhips and two-headed ponies. Ring, ring, ring into the silence, into the dead silence. Ring, 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 long after the kids who call up to ask about Prince Albert and a can have gone to bed. Ring, ring, ring. "Hello, Jackie, it's Morgan, and I felt you in my woods, you smart little shit. I smelled you in my woods, and how did you ever get the idea that you were safe in your world? My woods are there, too. Last chance, Jackie, get home, or we send out the troops. You won't have a chance. You won't." Jack got up and ran across the storeroom floor in his stocking feet. A light sweat that felt freezing cold seemed to cover his entire body. He opened the door a crack. Ring, 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 ring. Then finally, "Hello, Oatley Tap, and this better be good." Smokey's voice. A pause. "Hello." Another pause. "Fuck off." Smokey hung up with a bang, and Jack heard him recross the floor and then start up the stairs to the small overhead apartment he and Lori shared. Jack looked unbelievingly from the green slip of paper in his left hand to the small pile of bills, all ones, and change by his right. It was 11 o'clock the next morning, Thursday morning, and he had asked for his pay. "What is this?" he asked, still unable to believe it.
"You can read," Smokey said, "and you can count. You don't move as fast as I'd like, Jack, at least not yet, but you're bright enough."
Now he sat with the green slip in one hand and the money by the other. Dull anger began to pulse in the middle of his forehead like a vein. "Guest check," the green slip was headed. It was the exact same form Mrs. Banbury had used in the Golden Spoon. It read, "One hamburger, $1.35. One hamburger, $1.35. One large milk, 55 cents. One gin ale, 55 cents. Tax, 30 cents. At the bottom, the figure $4.10 was written in large numbers and circled. Jack had made $9 for his 4-to-1 stint. Smokey had charged off nearly half of it. What he had left by his right hand was $4.90. He looked up, furious, first at Lori, who looked away as if vaguely embarrassed, and then at Smokey, who simply looked back. "This is a cheat," he said thinly.
"Jack, that's not true. Look at the menu prices. That's not what I mean, and you know it."
Lori flinched a little, as if expecting Smokey to clout him one, but Smokey only looked at Jack with a kind of terrible patience.
"I didn't charge you for your bed, did I?" bed? Jack shouted, feeling the hot blood boil up into his cheeks. Some bed! Cut open burlap bags on a concrete floor! Some bed! I'd like to see you try to charge me for it, you dirty cheat! Lori made a scared sound and shot a look at Smokey. But Smokey only sat across from Jack in the booth, the thick blue smoke of a cheroot curling up between them. A fresh paper fry cook's hat was cocked forward on Smokey's narrow head. We talked about you dossing down back there, Smokey said. You asked if it came with a job. I said it did. No mention was made of your meals. If it had been brought up, maybe something could have been done. Maybe not. Point is, you never brought it up, so now you got to deal with that. Jack sat shaking, tears of anger standing in his eyes. He tried to talk, and nothing came out but a small, strangled groan. He was literally too furious to speak. Of course, if you wanted to discuss an employee's discount on your meals, now go to hell, Jack managed finally, snatching up the four singles and the little strew of change. Teach the next kid who comes in here how to look out for number one. I'm going. He crossed the floor toward the door, and in spite of his anger, he knew, did not just think, but flat out knew, that he wasn't going to make the sidewalk. Jack? He touched the doorknob, thought of grasping it and turning it, but that voice was undeniable and full of a certain threat. He dropped his hand and turned around, his anger leaving him. He suddenly felt shrunken and old. Lori had gone behind the bar where she was sweeping and humming. She had apparently decided that Smokey wasn't going to work Jack over with his fists, and since nothing else really mattered, everything was all right. You don't want to leave me in the lurch with my weekend crowd coming up. I want to get out of here. You cheated me. No, sir, Smokey said. I explained that. If anyone blotted your copybook, Jack, it was you. Now, we could discuss your meals, 50% off the food, maybe, and even free sodas. I never went that far before with the younger help I hire from time to time, but this weekend's going to be especially hairy, what with all the migrant labor in the county for the apple picking. And I like you, Jack. That's why I didn't clout you one when you raised your voice to me, although maybe I should have. But I need you over the weekend. Jack felt his rage return briefly and then die away again. What if I go anyhow? He asked. I'm $5 to the good anyway, and being out of this shitty little town might be just as good as a bonus. Looking at Jack, still smiling his narrow smile, Smokey said, You remember going into the men's last night to clean after some guy who whoopsed his cookies? Jack nodded. You remember what he looked like? Crew cut, khakis, so what? That's Digger Atwell. His real name's Carlton, but he spent 10 years taking care of the town cemetery, so everyone got calling him Digger. That was... 20-30 years ago. He went on the town cops back around the time Nixon got elected president. Now he's chief of police. Smokey picked up his cheroot, puffed at it, and looked at Jack. Digger and me go back, Smokey said. And if you was to just walk out of here now, Jack, I couldn't guarantee that you wouldn't have some trouble with Digger. Might end up getting sent home. Might end up picking the apples on the town's land. Oakley Township's got, 40 acres of good trees. Might end up getting beat up, or I've heard that old Digger's got a taste for kids on the road. Boys, mostly. Jack thought of that club-like penis. He felt both sick and cold. In here, you're under my wing, so to speak, Smokey said. Once you hit the street, who can say? Digger's apt to be cruising any place. You might get over the town line with no sweat. On the other hand, you might just see him pulling up beside you in that big Plymouth he drives. Digger ain't totally bright, but he does have a nose sometimes. Or someone might give him a call. Behind the bar, Lori was doing dishes. She dried her hands, turned on the radio, and began to sing along with an old Steppenwolf song. Tell you what, Smokey said. Hang in there, Jack. Work the weekend. Then I'll pack you into my pickup and drive you over the town line myself. How would that be? You'll go out of here Sunday noon with damn near $30 in your poke that you didn't have coming in. You'll go out thinking that Oatley's not such a bad place after all. So what do you say? Jack looked into those brown eyes, noted the yellow scleras and the small flecks of red. He noted Smokey's big, sincere smile, lined with false teeth. He even saw with a weird and terrifying sense of déjà vu that the fly was back on the paper fry cook's hat, preening and washing its hair-thin forelegs. He suspected Smokey knew that he knew that everything Updike had said was a lie and didn't even care. After working into the early hours of Saturday morning and then Sunday morning, Jack would sleep until maybe 2 Sunday afternoon. Smokey would tell him he couldn't give him that ride because Jack had woken up too late. Now he, Smokey, was too busy watching the Colts and the Patriots. And Jack would not only be too tired to walk, he would be too afraid that Smokey might lose interest in the Colts and Patriots just long enough to call his good friend Digger Atwell and say, "He's walking down Mill Road right now, Digger, old boy. Why don't you pick him up? Then get over here for the second half. Free beer. But don't you go puking in my urinal until I get the kid back here." That was one scenario. There were others that he could think of, each a little different, each really the same at bottom. Smokey Updike's smile widened a little. Chapter 10. Elroy. When I was 6, the tap, which had begun to wind down by this time on his previous 2 nights, was roaring along as if the patrons expected to greet the dawn. He saw 2 tables had vanished, victims of the fistfight that had broken out just before his last expedition into the John. Now people were dancing where the tables had been. "About time," Smokey said as Jack staggered the length of the bar on the inside and put the case down by the refrigerator compartments. "You get those in there and go back for the fucking bud. You should have brought that first anyway." Laurie didn't say hot, incredible pain exploded in his foot as Smokey drove one heavy shoe down on Jack's sneaker. Jack uttered a muffled scream and felt tears sting his eyes. "Shut up," Smokey said. "Laurie don't know shit from Shinola, and you are smart enough to know it. Get back in there and run me out a case of bud." He went back to the storeroom, limping on the foot Smokey had stomped, wondering if the bones in some of his toes might be broken. It seemed all too possible. His head roared with the smoke and noise and the jagged ripsaw rhythm of the Jenny Valley Boys, 2 of them now noticeably weaving on the bandstand. One thought stood out clearly. It might not be possible to wait until closing. He really might not be able to last that long. If Oatley was a prison and the Oatley tap was his cell, then surely exhaustion was as much his warder as Smokey Updike, maybe even more so. In spite of his worries about what the territories might be like at this place, the magic juice seemed more and more to promise him his only sure way out. He could drink some and flip over, and if he could manage to walk a mile west over there, 2 at the most, he could drink a bit more and flip back into the USA, well over the town line of this horrible little place, perhaps as far west as Bushville or even Pembroke. "When I was 6, when Jacko was 6, when he got the bud and stumbled, staggered out through the door again, and the tall, rangy cowboy with the big hands, the one who looked like Randolph Scott, was standing there looking at him. 'Hello, Jack,' he said, and Jack saw with rising terror that the irises of the man's eyes were as yellow as chicken claws. 'Didn't somebody tell you to get gone? You don't listen very good, do you?' Jack stood with a case of bud dragging at the ends of his arms, staring into those yellow eyes, and suddenly a horrid idea hammered into his mind that this had been the lurker in the tunnel, this man-thing with its dead yellow eyes. "Leave me alone," he said. The words came out in a wintry little whisper. He crowded closer. "You were supposed to get gone." Jack tried to back up, but now he was against the wall, and as the cowboy who looked like Randolph Scott leaned toward him, Jack could smell dead meat on its breath. Between the time Jack started work on Thursday at noon and 4 o'clock, when the tap's usual after-work crowd started to come in, the payphone with the "please limit your calls to 3-minute" sign over it rang twice. The first time it rang, Jack felt no fear at all, and it turned out to be only a solicitor for the United Fund. 2 hours later, as Jack was bagging up the last of the previous night's bottles, the telephone began to shrill again. This time his head snapped up like an animal which scents fire in a dry forest, except it wasn't fire he sensed, but ice. He turned toward the telephone, which was only 4 feet from where he was working, hearing the tendons in his neck creak. He thought he must see the payphone caked with ice, ice that was sweating through the phone's black plastic case, extruding from the holes in the earpiece and the mouthpiece in lines of blue ice as thin as pencil leads, hanging from the rotary dial and the coin return in icicle beards. But it was just the phone, and all the coldness and death was on the inside. He stared at it, hypnotized. "Jack!" Smokey yelled. "Answer the goddamn phone! What the fuck am I paying you for?" Jack looked toward Smokey as desperate as a cornered animal. But Smokey was staring back with the thin-lipped, out-of-patience expression that he got on his face just before he popped Lori one. He started toward the phone, barely aware that his feet were moving. He stepped deeper and deeper into that capsule of coldness, feeling the goose flesh run up his arms, feeling the moisture crackle in his nose. He reached out and grasped the phone. His hand went numb. He put it to his ear. His ear went numb. "Oatly tap," he said into that deadly blackness, and his mouth went numb. The voice that came out of the phone was the cracked, rasping croak of something long dead, some creature which could never be seen by the living. The sight of it would drive a living person insane, or strike him dead with frost etchings on his lips and staring eyes blinded by cataracts of ice. "Jack!" This scabrous, rattling voice whispered up out of the earpiece, and his face went numb, the way it did when you needed to spend a heavy day in the dentist chair and the guy needled you up with a little too much Novocaine. "You get your ass back home, Jack." From far away, a distance of light years, it seemed, he could hear his voice repeating, "Oatly tap, is anyone there? Hello? Hello?" Cold. So cold. His throat was numb. He drew breath and his lungs seemed to freeze. Soon the chambers of his heart would ice up and he would simply drop dead. That chilly voice whispered, "Bad things can happen to a boy alone on the road, Jack. Ask anybody." He hung the phone up with a quick, clumsy, reaching gesture. He pulled his hand back and then stood looking at the phone. "Was it the asshole, Jack?" Lori asked, and her voice was distant, but a little closer than his own voice had seemed a few moments ago. The world was coming back. On the handset of the payphone, he could see the shape of his hand, outlined in a glittering rhyme of frost. As he looked, the frost began to melt and run down the black plastic. That was the night, Thursday night, that Jack first saw Jenny County's answer to Randolph Scott. The crowd was a little smaller than it had been Wednesday night, very much a day-before-payday crowd, but there were still enough men present to fill the bar and spill over into the tables and booths. They were town men from a rural area where the plows were now probably rusting, forgotten in back sheds, men who perhaps wanted to be farmers but had forgotten how. There were a lot of John Deere caps in evidence, but to Jack, very few of these men looked as if they would be at home riding a tractor. These were men in gray chinos and brown chinos and green chinos, men with their names stitched on blue shirts and gold thread, men in square-toed dingo boots and men in great big clumping survivors. These men carried their keys on their belts. These men had wrinkles but no laugh lines. Their mouths were dour. These men wore cowboy hats, and when Jack looked at the bar from in back of the stools, there were as many as 8 who looked like Charlie Daniels in the chewing tobacco ads. But these men didn't chew. These men smoked cigarettes, and a lot of them. Jack was cleaning the bubble front of the jukebox when Digger Atwell came in. The juke was turned off, the Yankees were on the cable, and the men at the bar were watching intently. The night before, Atwell had been in the Oatly male's version of sports clothes, chinos, khaki shirt with a lot of pens in one of the 2 big pockets, steel-toed work boots. Tonight he was wearing a blue cop's uniform, A large gun with wood grips hung in a holster on his creaking leather belt. He glanced at Jack, who thought of Smokey saying, "I've heard that old Digger's got a taste for kids on the road, boys mostly," and flinched back as if guilty of something. Digger Atwell grinned a wide, slow grin. "Decided to stick around for a while, boy?" "Yes, sir," Jack muttered, and squirted more Windex onto the juke's bubble front, although it was already as clean as it was going to get. He was only waiting for Atwell to go away. After a while, Atwell did. Jack turned to watch the beefy cop cross to the bar, and that was when the man at the far left end of the bar turned around and looked at him. "Randolph Scott," Jack thought at once. "That's just who he looks like." But in spite of the rangy and uncompromising lines of his face, the real Randolph Scott had had an undeniable look of heroism. If his good looks had been harsh, they had also been part of a face that could smile. This man looked both bored and somehow crazy. And with real fright, Jack realized the man was looking at him, at Jack. Nor had he simply turned around during the commercial to see who might be in the bar. He had turned around to look at Jack. Jack knew this was so. The phone. The ringing phone. With a tremendous effort, Jack pulled his gaze away. He looked back into the bubble front of the juke and saw his own frightened face hovering ghost-like over the records inside. The telephone began to shriek on the wall. The man at the left end of the bar looked at it, and then looked back at Jack, who stood frozen by the jukebox with his bottle of Windex in one hand and a rag in the other, his hair stiffening, his skin freezing. "If it's that asshole again, I'm going to get me a whistle to start blowing down the phone when he calls Smokey," Lori was saying as she walked toward it. "I swear to God I am." She might have been an actress in a play, and all the customers' extras paid the standard SAG rate of $35 a day. The only two real people in the world were him and this dreadful cowboy with the big hands and the eyes Jack could not quite see. Suddenly, shockingly, the cowboy mouthed these words, "Get your ass home," and winked. The phone stopped ringing even as Lori stretched out her hand to it. Randolph Scott turned around, drained his glass, and yelled, "Bring me another tapper, okay?" "I'll be damned," Lori said. "That phone's got the ghosts." Later on, in the storeroom, Jack asked Lori who the guy was who looked like Randolph Scott.
"Who looks like who?" she asked.
"An old cowboy actor. He was sitting down at the end of the bar." She shrugged. "They all look the same to me, Jack. Just a bunch of swinging dicks out for a good time. On Thursday nights, they usually pay for it with the little woman's beano money." "He calls beers tappers." Her eyes lit.
"Oh, yeah, him. He looks mean."
She said this last with actual appreciation, as if admiring the straightness of his nose or the whiteness of his smile.
"Who is he?"
"I don't know his name," Lori said. "He's only been around last week or two. I guess the mill must be hiring again."
"For Christ's sake, Jack, did I tell you to run me out of keg or not?"
Jack had been in the process of walking one of the big kegs of bush into the foot of the hand dolly. Because his weight and the keg's foot were so close, it was an act requiring a good deal of careful balancing. When Smokey shouted from the doorway, Lori screamed and Jack jumped. He lost control of the keg, and it went over on its side, the cap shooting out like a champagne cork, beer following in a white gold jet. Smokey was still shouting at him, but Jack could only stare at the beer, frozen, until Smokey popped him one. When he got back out to the tap room, perhaps 20 minutes later, holding a Kleenex against his swelling nose, Randolph Scott had been gone.
"I'm six. John Benjamin Sawyer is six. Six," Jack shook his head, trying to clear this steady, repeating thought out, as the rangy millhand who was not a millhand leaned closer and closer, his eyes yellow and somehow scaly. It blinked, a rapid, milky, swimming blink, and Jack realized it had nictitating membranes over its eyeballs.
You were supposed to get gone, it whispered again, and reached toward Jack with hands that were beginning to twist and plate and harden.
The door banged open, letting in a raucous flood of the Oak Ridge boys.
Jack, if you don't quit lollygagging, I'm going to have to make you sorry, Smokey said from behind Randolph Scott.
Scott stepped backward. No melting, hardening hooves here. His hands were just hands again, big and powerful, their backs crisscrossed with prominent ridged veins. There was another milky, swirling sort of blink that didn't involve the eyelids at all. And then the man's eyes were not yellow, but a simple, faded blue. He gave Jack a final glance and then headed toward the men's room.
Smokey came toward Jack now, his paper cap tipped forward, his narrow weasel's head slightly inclined, his lips parted to show his alligator teeth.
"Don't make me speak to you again," Smokey said. "This is your last warning, and don't you think I don't mean it?"
As it had against Osmond, Jack's fury suddenly rose up. That sort of fury, closely linked as it is to a sense of hopeless injustice, is perhaps never as strong as it is at 12. College students sometimes think they feel it, but it is usually little more than an intellectual echo. This time, it boiled over.
"I'm not your dog, so don't you treat me like I am," Jack said, and took a step toward Smokey Updike on legs that were still rubbery with fear.
Surprised, possibly even flabbergasted by Jack's totally unexpected anger, Smokey backed up a step.
"Jack, I'm warning you." "No, man, I'm warning you," Jack heard himself say. "I'm not Laurie. I don't want to be hit. And if you hit me, I'm going to hit you back or something."
Smokey Updike's discomposure was only momentary. He had most assuredly not seen everything, not living in Oatley, he hadn't, but he thought he had. And even for a minor leaguer, sometimes assurance can be enough. He reached out to grab Jack's collar.
"Don't you smart off to me, Jack," he said, drawing Jack close. "As long as you're an Oatley, my dog is just what you are. As long as you're an Oatley, I'll pet you when I want, and I'll beat you when I want."
He administered a single neck-snapping shake. Jack bit his tongue and cried out. Hectic spots of anger now glowed in Smokey's pale cheeks like cheap rouge.
"You may not think that is so right now, but Jack, it is. As long as you're an Oatley, you're my dog, and you'll be an Oatley until I decide to let you go. And we might as well start getting that learned right now."
He pulled his fist back. For a moment, the three naked 60-watt bulbs which hung in this narrow hallway sparkled crazily on the diamond chips of the horseshoe-shaped pinky ring he wore. Then the fist pistoned forward and slammed into the side of Jack's face. He was driven backward into the graffiti-covered wall, the side of his face first flaring and then going numb. The taste of his own blood washed into his mouth. Smokey looked at him, the close, judgmental stare of a man who might be thinking about buying a heifer or a lottery number. He must not have seen the expression he wanted to see in Jack's eye, because he grabbed the dazed boy again, presumably the better to center him for a second shot. At that moment, a woman shrieked from the tap.
"No, Glenn, no!"
There was a tangle of bellowing male voices, most of them alarmed. Another woman screamed, a high, drilling sound. Then a gunshot.
"Shit on toast," Smokey cried, enunciating each word as carefully as an actor on a Broadway stage.
He threw Jack back against the wall, whirled, and slammed out through the swinging door. The gun went off again, and there was a scream of pain. Jack was sure of only one thing. The time had come to get out. Not at the end of tonight's shift, or tomorrow's, or on Sunday morning. Right now. The uproar seemed to be quieting down. There were no sirens, so maybe nobody had gotten shot. But, Jack remembered, cold, the mill hand who looked like Randolph Scott was still down in the men's can. Jack went into the chilly, beer-smelling storeroom, knelt by the kegs, and felt around for his pack. Again, there was that suffocating certainty as his fingers encountered nothing but thin air and the dirty concrete floor that one of them, Smokey or Laurie, had seen him hide the pack and had taken it. "All the better to keep you in Oatley, my dear." Then relief, almost as suffocating as the fear, when his fingers touched the nylon.
Jack donned the pack and looked longingly toward the loading door at the back of the storeroom. He would much rather use that door. He didn't want to go down to the fire door at the end of the hall. That was too close to the men's bathroom. But if he opened the loading door, a red light would go on at the bar. Even if Smokey was still sorting out the ruckus on the floor, Lori would see that light and tell him. So, he went to the door which gave on the back corridor. He eased it open a crack and applied one eye. The corridor was empty. All right, that was cool. Randolph Scott had tapped a kidney and gone back to where the action was while Jack was getting his backpack. Great. Yeah, except maybe he's still in there. You want to meet him in the hall, Jackie? Want to watch his eyes turn yellow again? Wait until you're sure. But he couldn't do that, because Smokey would see he wasn't out in the tap, helping Lori and Gloria swab tables or behind the bar unloading the dishwasher. He would come back here to finish teaching Jack what his place was in the great scheme of things. So what? Get going. Maybe he's in there waiting for you, Jackie. Maybe he's going to jump out just like a big bad Jack in the box. The lady or the tiger? Smokey or the mill hand? Jack hesitated a moment longer in an agony of indecision. That the man with the yellow eyes was still in the bathroom was a possibility. That Smokey would be back was a certainty. Jack opened the door and stepped out into the narrow hallway. The pack on his back seemed to gain weight, an eloquent accusation of his planned escape to anyone who might see it. He started down the hallway, moving grotesquely on tiptoe in spite of the thundering music and the roar of the crowd, his heart hammering in his chest. I was six. Jackie was six. So what? Why did that keep coming back? Six. The corridor seemed longer. It was like walking on a treadmill. The fire door at the far end seemed to draw closer only by agonizing degrees. Sweat now coated his brow and his upper lip. His gaze flicked steadily toward the door to the right with the black outline of a dog on it. Beneath this outline was the word pointers, and at the end of the corridor, a door of fading, peeling red. The sign on the door said emergency use only. Alarm will sound. In fact, the alarm bell had been broken for 2 years. Lori had told him so when Jack had hesitated about using the door to take out the trash. Finally, almost there, directly opposite pointers. He's in there, I know he is, and if he jumps out, I'll scream. I'll... Jack put out a trembling right hand and touched the crash bar of the emergency door. It felt blessedly cool to his touch. For one moment, he really believed he would simply fly out of the pitcher plant and into the night, free. Then the door behind him suddenly banged open, the door to Setters, and a hand grabbed his backpack. Jack uttered a high-pitched, despairing shriek of a trapped animal and lunged at the emergency door, heedless of the pack and the magic juice inside it. If the straps had broken, he would have simply gone fleeing through the trashy, weedy, vacant lot behind the tap and never mind anything else. But the straps were tough nylon and didn't break. The door opened a little way, revealing a brief, dark wedge of the night, and then thumped shut again. Jack was pulled into the women's room. He was whirled around and then thrown backward. If he had hit the wall dead on, the bottle of magic juice would undoubtedly have shattered in the pack, drenching his few clothes and good old Rand McNally with the odor of rotting grapes. Instead, he hit the room's one wash basin with the small of his back. The pain was giant, excruciating. The mill hand was walking toward him slowly, hitching up his jeans with hands that had begun to twist and thicken. "You were supposed to be gone, kid," he said, his voice roughening, becoming at every moment more like the snarl of an animal. Jack began to edge to his left, his eyes never leaving the man's face. His eyes now seemed almost transparent, not just yellow, but lighted from within. The eyes of a hideous Halloween jack-o'-lantern. "But you can trust old Arrow, eh?" the cowboy thing said, and now it grinned to reveal a mouthful of curving teeth, some of them jaggedly broken off, some black with rot. Jack screamed. "You can trust Arrow, eh?" it said, its words now hardly discernible from a dog-like growl. "It ain't gonna hurt you too bad. You'll be all right," it growled, moving toward Jack. "You'll be all right, oh yeah, you'll..." It continued to talk, but Jack could no longer tell what it was saying. Now it was only snarling.
Jack's foot hit the tall waste can by the door. As the cowboy thing reached for him with its hoof-like hands, Jack grabbed the can and threw it. The can bounced off the Elroy thing's chest. Jack tore open the bathroom door and lunged to the left, toward the emergency door. He slammed into the crash bar, aware that Elroy was right behind him. He lurched into the dark behind the Oatly tap. There was a colony of overloaded garbage cans to the right of the door. Jack blindly swept three of them behind him, heard them clash and rattle, and then a howl of fury as Elroy stumbled into them. He whirled in time to see the thing go down. There was even a moment to realize, oh, dear Jesus, a tail, it's got something like a tail, that the thing was now almost entirely an animal. Golden light fell from its eyes in weird rays, like bright light falling through twin keyholes. Jack backed away from it, pulling the pack from his back, trying to undo the catches with fingers which felt like blocks of wood, his mind a roaring confusion. Jackie was six. God help me, Speedy. Jackie was six. God, of thoughts and incoherent pleas. The thing snarled and flailed at the garbage cans. Jack saw one hoof hand go up and then come whistling down, splitting the side of one corrugated metal can in a jagged slash a yard long. It got up again, stumbled, almost fell, and then began to lurch toward Jack, its snarling, rippling face now almost at chest level. And somehow, through its barking growls, he was able to make out what it was saying. Now I'm not just going to ream you, little chicken. Now I'm going to kill you after. Hearing it with his ears or in his head? It didn't matter. The space between this world and that had shrunk from a universe to a mere membrane. The Elroy thing snarled and came toward him, now unsteady and awkward on its rear feet, its clothes bulging in all the wrong places, its tongue swinging from its fanged mouth. Here was the vacant lot behind Smokey Updike's Oatly tap. Yes, here it was at last, choked with weeds and blown trash, a rusty bedspring here, the grill of a 1957 Ford over there, and a ghastly sickle moon like a bent bone in the sky overhead, turning every shard of broken glass into a dead and staring eye. And this hadn't begun in New Hampshire, had it? No, it hadn't begun when his mother got sick, or with the appearance of Lester Parker. It had begun when Jackie was six, when we all lived in California and no one lived anywhere else, and Jackie was... He fumbled at the straps of his pack. It came again, seeming almost to dance, for a moment reminding him of some animated Disney cartoon figure in the chancy moonlight. Crazily, Jack began to laugh. The thing snarled and leaped at him. The swipe of those heavy hoof claws again missed him by barest inches as he danced back through the weeds and litter. The Elroy thing came down on the bedspring and somehow became entangled in it. Howling, snapping white gobbets of foam into the air, it pulled and twisted and lunged, one foot buried deep in the rusty coils. Jack groped inside his pack for the bottle. He dug past socks and dirty undershorts and a wadded, fragrant pair of jeans. He seized the neck of the bottle and yanked it out. The Elroy thing split the air with a howl of rage, finally pulling free of the bedspring. Jack hit the cindery, weedy, scruffy ground and rolled over, the last two fingers of his left hand hooked around one pack strap, his right hand holding the bottle. He worked at the cap with the thumb and forefinger of his left hand, the pack dangling and swinging. The cap spun off. Can it follow me? He wondered incoherently, tipping the bottle to his lips. When I go, do I punch some kind of hole through the middle of things? Can it follow me through and finish me on the other side? Jack's mouth filled with that rotten, dead grape taste. He gagged, his throat closing, seeming to actually reverse direction. Now that awful taste filled his sinuses and nasal passages as well, and he uttered a deep, shaking groan. He could hear the Elroy thing screaming now, but the scream seemed far away, as if it were on one end of the Oatly tunnel, and he, Jack, were falling rapidly toward the other end. And this time there was a sense of falling, and he thought, oh my God, what if I just flip my stupid self over a cliff or off a mountain over there? He held on to the pack and the bottle, his eyes screwed desperately shut, waiting for whatever might happen next, Elroy thing or no Elroy thing, territories or oblivion. And the thought which had haunted him all night came swinging back like a dancing carousel horse, Silver Lady, maybe Ella Speed.
He caught it and wrote it down in a cloud of the magic juice's awful smell, holding it, waiting for whatever would happen next, feeling his clothes change on his body.
Six. Oh, yes, when we were all six and nobody was anything else, and it was California. Who blows that sax, Daddy? Is it Dexter Gordon? Or is it what does Mom mean when she says we're living on a fault line? And where do you go, Daddy? You and Uncle Morgan. Oh, Daddy, sometimes he looks at you like there's a fault line in his head and an earthquake going on behind his eyes, and you're dying in it. Oh, Daddy!
Falling, twisting, turning in the middle of limbo, in the middle of a smell like a purple cloud. Jack Sawyer, John Benjamin Sawyer. Jackie was six when it started to happen. And who blew that sax, Daddy? Who blew it when I was six, when Jackie was six, when Jackie... Chapter 11. The Death of Jerry Bledsoe.
Was six... When it really started, Daddy, when the engines that eventually pulled him to Oatley and beyond began to chug away. There had been loud saxophone music. Six. Jackie was six.
At first his attention had been entirely on the toy his father had given him, a scale model of a London taxi. The toy car was heavy as a brick, and on the smooth wooden floors of the new office, a good push sent it rumbling straight across the room. Late afternoon, first grade, all the way on the other side of August. A neat new car that rolled like a tank on the strip of bare wood behind the couch. A contented, relaxed feeling in the air-conditioned office. No more work to do, no more phone calls that couldn't wait until the next day. Jack pushed the heavy toy taxi down the strip of bare wood, barely able to hear the rumbling of the solid rubber tires under the soloing of a saxophone. The black car struck one of the legs of the couch, spun sideways, and stopped. Jack crawled down, and Uncle Morgan had parked himself in one of the chairs on the other side of the couch. Each man nursed a drink. Soon they'd put down their glasses, switch off the turntable and the amplifier, and go downstairs to their cars. When we were all six and nobody was anything else, and it was California, "Who's playing that sax?" he heard Uncle Morgan ask, and half in a reverie heard that familiar voice in a new way, something whispery and hidden in Morgan Sloat's voice coiled into Jackie's ear. He touched the top of the toy taxi and his fingers were as cold as if it were of ice, not English steel. "That's Dexter Gordon is who that is," his father answered. His voice was as lazy and friendly as it always was, and Jack slipped his hand around the heavy taxi. "Good record. Daddy plays the horn. It is a nice old record, isn't it? I'll have to look for it." And then Jack thought he knew what that strangeness in Uncle Morgan's voice was all about. Uncle Morgan didn't really like jazz at all. He just pretended to in front of Jack's father. Jack had known this fact about Morgan Sloat for most of his childhood, and he thought it was silly that his father couldn't see it too. Uncle Morgan was never going to look for a record called Daddy Plays the Horn. He was just flattering Phil Sawyer. And maybe the reason Phil Sawyer didn't see it was that, like everyone else, he never paid quite enough attention to Morgan Sloat. Uncle Morgan, smart and ambitious, smart as a wolverine, sneaky as a courthouse lawyer, Lily said. Good old Uncle Morgan deflected observation. Your eye just sort of naturally slid off him. When he was a kid, Jackie would have bet his teachers would have had trouble even remembering his name. "Imagine what this guy would be like over there," Uncle Morgan said, for once fully claiming Jack's attention. That falsity still played through his voice, but it was not Sloat's hypocrisy that jerked up Jackie's head and tightened his fingers on his heavy toy. The words "over there" had sailed straight into his brain and were now gonging like chimes. Because over there was the country of Jack's daydreams. He had known that immediately. His father and Uncle Morgan had forgotten that he was behind the couch, and they were going to talk about the daydreams. His father knew about the daydream country. Jack could never have mentioned the daydreams to either his father or his mother, but his father knew about the daydreams because he had to. Simple as that. And the next step, felt along Jack's emotions more than consciously expressed, was that his dad helped keep the daydreams safe. But for some reason, equally difficult to translate from emotion into language, the conjunction of Morgan Sloat and the daydreams made the boy uneasy.
Hey? Uncle Morgan said. This guy would really turn him around, wouldn't he? They'd probably make him Duke of the Blasted Lands or something.
Well, probably not that, Phil Sawyer said. Not if they liked him as much as we do.
But Uncle Morgan doesn't like him, Dad, Jackie thought, suddenly clear that this was important. He doesn't like him at all. Not really. He thinks that music is too loud. He thinks it takes something from him.
Oh, you know a lot more about it than I do, Uncle Morgan said, in a voice that sounded easy and relaxed.
Well, I've been there more often, but you're doing a good job of catching up. Jackie heard that his father was smiling.
Oh, I've learned a few things, Phil. But really, you know, I'll never get over being grateful to you for showing all that to me.
The two syllables of grateful filled with smoke and the sound of breaking glass. But all of these little warnings could not do more than dent Jack's intense, almost blissful satisfaction. They were talking about the daydreams. It was magical that such a thing was possible. What they said was beyond him. Their terms and vocabulary were too adult, but six-year-old Jack experienced again the wonder and joy of the daydreams, and was at least old enough to understand the direction of their conversation. The daydreams were real, and Jackie somehow shared them with his father. That was half his joy.
"Let me just get something straight," Uncle Morgan said, and Jackie saw the word straight as a pair of lines nodding around each other like snakes. "They have magic like we have physics, right? We're talking about an agrarian monarchy using magic instead of science."
"Sure," Phil Sawyer said.
"And, presumably, they've gone on like that for centuries. Their lives have never changed very much."
"Except for political upheavals, that's right."
Then Uncle Morgan's voice tightened, and the excitement he tried to conceal cracked little whips within his consonants.
"Well, forget about the political stuff. Suppose we think about us for a change. You'll say, and I'd agree with you, Phil, that we've done pretty well out of the territories already, and that we'd have to be careful about how we introduce changes there. I have no problem at all with that position. I feel the same way myself."
Jackie could feel his father's silence.
"Okay," Sloat continued. "Let's go with the concept that within a situation basically advantageous to ourselves, we can spread the benefits around to anybody on our side. We don't sacrifice the advantage, but we're not greedy about the bounty it brings. We owe these people, Phil. Look what they've done for us. I think we could put ourselves into a really synergistic situation over there. Our energy can feed their energy and come up with stuff we've never even thought of, Phil, and we end up looking generous, which we are, but which also doesn't hurt us."
He would be frowning forward, the palms of his hands pressed together.
"Of course, I don't have a total window on this situation, you know that, but I think the synergy alone is worth the price of admission, to tell you the truth. But, Phil, can you imagine how much fucking clout we'd swing if we gave them electricity? If we got modern weapons to the right guys over there? Do you have any idea? I think it'd be awesome. Awesome!"
The damp, squashy sound of his clapping hands.
"I don't want to catch you unprepared or anything, but I thought it might be time for us to think along those lines. To think, territories-wise, about increasing our involvement."
Phil Sawyer still said nothing. Uncle Morgan slapped his hands together again. Finally, Phil Sawyer said in a noncommittal voice, "You want to think about increasing our involvement?"
"I think it's the way to go. And I can give you chapter and verse, Phil, but I shouldn't have to. You can probably remember as well as I can what it was like before we started going there together. Hey, maybe we could have made it all on our own, and maybe we would have. But as for me, I'm grateful not to be representing a couple of broken-down strippers and little Timmy Tiptoe anymore."
"Hold on," Jack's father said.
"Airplanes," Uncle Morgan said. "Think airplanes."
Hold on there, Morgan. I have a lot of ideas that apparently have yet to occur to you."
"I'm always ready for new ideas," Morgan said, and his voice was smoky again.
"Okay, I think we have to be careful about what we do over there, partner. I think anything major, any real changes we bring about, just might turn around and bite our asses back here. Everything has consequences, and some of those consequences might be on the uncomfortable side.
Like what? Uncle Morgan asked.
Like war.
That's nuts, Phil. We've never seen anything, unless you mean Bledsoe.
I do mean Bledsoe. Was that a coincidence?
Bledsoe? Jack wondered. He had heard the name before, but it was vague.
Well, that's a long way from war, to put it mildly, and I don't concede the connection anyhow.
All right. Do you remember hearing about how a stranger assassinated the old king over there a long time ago? You ever hear about that?
Yeah, I suppose, Uncle Morgan said, and Jack heard again the falseness in his voice.
His father's chair squeaked. He was taking his feet off his desk, leaning forward.
The assassination touched off a minor war over there. The followers of the old king had to put down a rebellion led by a couple of disgruntled nobles. These guys saw their chance to take over and run things, seize lands, impound property, throw their enemies in jail, make themselves rich.
Hey, be fair, Morgan broke in. I heard about this stuff, too. They also wanted to bring some kind of political order to a crazy, inefficient system. Sometimes you have to be tough starting out. I can see that.
And it's not for us to make judgments about their politics, I agree. But here's my point. That little war over there lasted about 3 weeks. When it was over, maybe 100 people had been killed. Fewer, probably. Did anyone ever tell you when that war began? What year it was? What day?
No, Uncle Morgan muttered in a sulky voice.
It was the 1st of September, 1939. Over here, it was the day Germany invaded Poland. His father stopped talking, and Jackie, clutching his black toy taxi behind the couch, yawned silently but hugely.
That screwball, Uncle Morgan finally said. Their war started ours? Do you really believe that?
I do believe that, Jack's father said. I believe a 3-week squabble over there in some way sparked off a war here that lasted 6 years and killed millions of people, yes.
Well, Uncle Morgan said, and Jack could see him beginning to huff and blow.
There's more. I've talked to lots of people over there about this, and the feeling I get is that the stranger who assassinated the king was a real stranger, if you see what I mean. Those who saw him got the feeling that he was uncomfortable with territory's clothes. He acted like he was unsure of local customs. He didn't understand the money right away.
Ah,
yes. If they hadn't torn him to pieces right after he stuck a knife into the king, we could be sure about this. But I'm sure anyhow that he was...
like us.
Like us. That's right. A visitor. Morgan, I don't think we can mess around too much over there, because we simply don't know what the effects will be. To tell you the truth, I think we're affected all the time by things that go on in the territories.
And should I tell you another crazy thing?
Why not? Sloat answered.
That's not the only other world out there.
Bullshit, Sloat said.
I mean it. I've had the feeling once or twice when I was there that I was near to somewhere else, the territory's territories.
Yes, Jack thought, that's right. It has to be. The daydream's daydreams, someplace even more beautiful. And on the other side of that is the daydream's daydreams, daydreams. And on the other side of that is another place, another world, nicer still.
He realized for the first time that he had become very sleepy.
The daydreams, daydreams.
And then he was almost immediately asleep, the heavy little taxi in his lap, his whole body simultaneously weighty with sleep, anchored to the strip of wooden floor, and so blissfully light.
The conversation must have continued. There must have been much that Jackie missed.
He rose and fell, heavy and light, through the second hole side of Daddy Plays the Horn. And during that time, Morgan Sloat must at first have argued, gently, but with what squeezings of his fists, what contortions of his forehead, for his plan. Then he must have allowed himself to seem persuadable, then finally persuaded by his partner's doubts.
At the end of this conversation, which returned to the 12-year-old Jackie Sawyer in the dangerous borderland between Oatley, New York, and a nameless territory's village, Morgan Sloat had allowed himself to seem not only persuaded, but positively grateful for the lessons. When Jack woke up, the first thing he heard was his father asking, "Hey, did Jack disappear or something?" And the second thing was Uncle Morgan saying, "Hell, I guess you're right, Phil. You have a way of seeing right to the heart of things. You're great the way you do that." "Where the hell is Jack?" his father said. And Jack stirred behind the couch, really waking up now. The black taxi thudded to the floor. "Aha," Uncle Morgan said. "Little pitchers and big ears, Poudette." "You behind there, kiddo?" his father said. Noises of chairs pushing back across the wooden floor, of men standing up. He said, "Ooh," and slowly lifted the taxi back into his lap. His legs felt stiff and uncomfortable. When he stood, they would tingle. His father laughed. Footsteps came toward him. Morgan Sloat's red, puffy face appeared over the top of the couch. Jack yawned and pushed his knees into the back of the couch. His father's face appeared beside Sloat's. His father was smiling. For a moment, both of those grown-up adult male heads seemed to be floating over the top of the couch. "Let's move on home, sleepyhead," his father said. When the boy looked into Uncle Morgan's face, he saw calculation sink into his skin, slide underneath his jolly fat man's cheeks like a snake beneath a rock. He looked like Richard Sloat's daddy again, like good old Uncle Morgan who always gave spectacular Christmas and birthday presents, like good old sweaty Uncle Morgan so easy not to notice. But what did he look like before? Like a human earthquake. Like a man crumbling apart over the fault line behind his eyes. Like something all wound up and waiting to explode. "How about a little ice cream on the way home, Jack?" Uncle Morgan said to him. "That sound good to you?"
"Ah," Jack said.
"Yeah, we can stop off at that place in the lobby," his father said.
"Yummy, yum, yum," Uncle Morgan said. "Now we're really talking about synergy."
And smiled at Jack once more. This happened when he was 6, and in the midst of his weightless tumble through limbo, it happened again. The horrible purple taste of Speedy's juice backed up into his mouth, into the passages behind his nose, and all of that languid afternoon of 6 years before replayed itself out in his mind. He saw it just as if the magic juice brought total recall, and so speedily that he lived through that afternoon in the same few seconds which told him that this time the magic juice really was going to make him vomit. Uncle Morgan's eyes smoking, and inside Jack a question smoking too, demanding to finally come out. Who played... What changes... Who plays those changes, Daddy? Who... killed Jerry Bledsoe? The magic juice forced itself into the boy's mouth. Stinging threads of it nauseatingly trickled into his nose, and just as Jack felt loose earth beneath his hands, he gave up and vomited rather than drown. What killed Jerry Bledsoe? Foul purple stuff shot from Jack's mouth, choking him, and he blindly pushed himself backward, his feet and legs snagged in tall, stiff weeds. Jack pushed himself up on his hands and knees and waited, patient as a mule, his mouth drooping open for the second attack. His stomach clenched, and he did not have time to groan before more of the stinking juice burned up through his chest and throat and spattered out of his mouth. Ropey pink strings of saliva hung from his lips, and Jack feebly brushed them away. He wiped his hand on his pants. Jerry Bledsoe, yes, Jerry, who'd always had his name spelled out on his shirt like a gas station attendant. Jerry, who had died when... The boy shook his head and wiped his hands across his mouth again. He spat into a nest of saw-toothed wild grass, sprouting like a giant's corsage out of the gray-brown earth. Some dim animal instinct he did not understand made him push loose earth over the pinkish pool of vomit. Another reflex made him brush the palms of his hands against his trousers. Finally, he looked up. He was kneeling in the last of the evening light on the edge of a dirt lane. No horrible Elroy thing pursued him. He had known that immediately. Dogs penned in a wooden cage-like enclosure barked and snarled at him, thrusting their snouts through the cracks of their jail. On the other side of the fenced-in dogs was a rambling wooden structure, and from here, too, doggy noises rose up into the immense sky. These were unmistakably similar to the noises Jack had just been hearing from the other side of a wall in the Oatley Tap, the sounds of drunken men bellowing at each other. A bar. Here it would be an inn or a public house, Jack imagined. Now that he was no longer sickened by Speedy's juice, he could smell the pervasive, yeasty odors of malt and hops. He could not let the men from the inn discover him. For a moment, he imagined himself running from all those dogs, yipping and growling through the cracks in their enclosure, and then he stood up. The sky seemed to tilt over his head, to darken. And back home, in his world, what was happening? A nice little disaster in the middle of Oatley? Maybe a nice little flood? A sweet little fire? Jack slipped quietly backward away from the inn, then began to move sideways through the tall grass. Perhaps 60 yards away, thick candles burned in the windows of the only other building he could see. From somewhere not far off to his right drifted the odor of pigs. When Jack had gone half the distance between the inn and the house, the dogs ceased growling and snapping, and he slowly began walking forward toward the western road. The night was dark and moonless. Jerry Bledsoe. There were other houses, though Jack did not see them until he was nearly before them. Except for the noisy drinkers behind him at the inn, here in the country, territory's people went to bed when the sun did. No candles burned in these small, square windows. Themselves squarish and dark, the houses on either side of the western road sat in a puzzling isolation. Something was wrong, as in a visual game from a child's magazine, but Jack could not identify it. Nothing hung upside down, nothing burned, nothing seemed extravagantly out of place. Most of the houses had thick, fuzzy roofs, which resembled haystacks with crew cuts, but Jack assumed that these were thatch. He had heard of it, but never seen it before. Morgan, he thought with a sudden thrill of panic. Morgan of Oris, and saw the two of them, the man with long hair and a built-up boot, and his father's sweaty, workaholic partner, for a moment jumbled up together. Morgan sloat with pirate's hair and a hitch in his walk. But Morgan, this world's Morgan, was not what was wrong with this picture. Jack was just now passing a short, squat, one-story building, like an inflated rabbit hutch, crazily half-timbered with wide, black wooden X's. A fuzzy, crew-cut thatch capped this building, too. If he were walking out of Oatley, or even running out of Oatley, to be closer to the truth, what would he expect to see in the single, dark window of this hutch for giant rabbits? He knew. The dancing glimmer of a television screen. But of course, territories' houses did not have television sets inside them, and the absence of that colorful glimmer was not what had puzzled him. It was something else, something so much an aspect of any grouping of houses along a road that its absence left a hole in the landscape. You noticed the hole even if you could not quite identify what was absent. Television sets. Jack continued past the half-timbered little building and saw ahead of him, its front door set only inches back from the verge of the road, another gnomishly small dwelling. This one seemed to have a sod, not a thatched roof, and Jack smiled to himself. This tiny village had reminded him of Hobbiton. Would a hobbit cable stringer pull up here and say to the lady of the shack, doghouse, "Anyhow, would he say, 'Ma'am, we're installing cable in your area, and for a small monthly fee, hit you up right now. You get 15 new channels, you get Midnight Blue, you get the all-sports and all-weather channels, you get...'" And that, he suddenly realized, was it. In front of these houses were no poles, no wiring. No TV antennas complicated the sky, no tall wooden poles marched the length of the western road, because in the territories there was no electricity. Which was why he had not permitted himself to identify the absent element. Jerry Bledsoe had been, at least part of the time, Sawyer and Sloat's electrician and handyman. When his father and Morgan Sloat used that name, Bledsoe, he thought he had never heard it before. Though, having remembered it, he must have heard the handyman's last name once or twice. But Jerry Bledsoe was almost always just Jerry, as it said above the pocket on his work shirt. Can't Jerry do something about the air conditioning? Get Jerry to oil the hinges on that door, will you? The squeaks are driving me batshit. And Jerry would appear, his work clothes clean and pressed, his thinning, rust-red hair combed flat, his glasses round and earnest, and quietly fix whatever was wrong. There was a Mrs. Jerry who kept the creases sharp and clean in the tan work pants, and several small Jerrys, whom Sawyer and Sloat invariably remembered at Christmas. Jack had been small enough to associate the name Jerry with Tom Cat's eternal adversary, and so imagined that the handyman and Mrs. Jerry and the little Jerrys lived in a giant mouse hole, accessible by a curved arch cut into a baseboard. But who had killed Jerry Bledsoe? His father and Morgan Sloat, always so sweet to the Bledsoe children at Christmas time? Jack stepped forward into the darkness of the western road, wishing that he had forgotten completely about Sawyer and Sloat's handyman, that he had fallen asleep as soon as he had crawled behind the couch. Sleep was what he wanted now, wanted it far more than the uncomfortable thoughts which that 6 years dead conversation had aroused in him. Jack promised himself that as soon as he was sure he was at least a couple of miles past the last house, he would find some place to sleep. A field would do, even a ditch. His legs did not want to move anymore. All his muscles, even his bones, seemed twice their weight. It had been just after one of those times when Jack had wandered into some enclosed place after his father and found that Phil Sawyer had somehow contrived a disappearance. Later, his father would manage to vanish from his bedroom, from the dining room, from the conference room at Sawyer and Sloat. On this occasion, he executed his mystifying trick in the garage beside the house on Rodeo Drive. Jack, sitting unobserved on the little knob of raised land, which was the closest thing to a hill offered by this section of Beverly Hills, saw his father leave their house by the front door, cross the lawn while digging in his pockets for money or keys, and let himself into the garage by the side door. The white door on the right side should have swung up seconds later, but it remained stubbornly closed. Then Jack realized that his father's car was where it had been all this Saturday morning, parked at the curb directly in front of the house. Lily's car was gone. She'd plugged a cigarette into her mouth and announced that she was taking herself off to a screening of Dirt Track, the latest film by the director of Death's Darling, and nobody by God had better try to stop her, and so the garage was empty. For minutes, Jack waited for something to happen. Neither the side door nor the big front doors opened. Eventually, Jack slid down off the grassy elevation, went to the garage, and let himself in. The wide, familiar space was entirely empty. Dark oil stains patterned the gray cement floor. Tools hung from silver hooks set into the walls. Jack grunted in astonishment, called out, "Dad!" and looked at everything again, just to make sure. This time he saw a cricket hop toward the shadowy protection of a wall, and for a second almost could have believed that magic was real and some malign wizard had happened along and... The cricket reached the wall and slipped into an invisible crack. No, his father had not been turned into a cricket. Of course he had not. "Hey," the boy said to himself, it seemed. He walked backward to the side door and left the garage. Sunlight fell on the lush, springy lawns of Rodeo Drive. He would have called someone, but whom? The police? "My daddy walked into the garage and I couldn't find him in there, and now I'm scared." 2 hours later, Phil Sawyer came walking up from the Beverly Wilshire end of the street. He carried his jacket over his shoulder, had pulled down the knot of his tie. To Jack, he looked like a man returning from a journey around the world. Jack jumped down from his anxious elevation and tore toward his father. "You sure cover the ground," his father said, smiling, and Jack flattened himself against his legs. "I thought you were taking a nap, traveling Jack." They heard the telephone ringing as they came up the walk, and some instinct, perhaps the instinct to keep his father close, made Jackie pray that it had already rung a dozen times, that whoever was calling would hang up before they reached the front door. His father ruffled the hair on his crown, put his big warm hand on the back of his neck, then pulled open the door and made it to the phone in 5 long strides. "Yes, Morgan," Jackie heard his father say. "Oh? Bad news? You'd better tell me yes." After a long moment of silence, in which the boy could hear the tinny, rasping sound of Morgan Sloat's voice stealing through the telephone wires, "Oh, Jerry! My God, poor Jerry! I'll be right over." Then his father looked straight at him, not smiling, not winking, not doing anything but taking him in. "I'll come over, Morgan. I'll have to bring Jack, but he can wait in the car." Jack felt his muscles relax and was so relieved that he did not ask why he had to wait in the car, as he would have at any other time. Phil drove up Rodeo Drive to the Beverly Hills Hotel, turned left onto Sunset, and pointed the car toward the office building. He said nothing. His father zipped through the oncoming traffic and swung the car into the parking lot beside the office building. Already in the lot were 2 police cars, a fire truck, Uncle Morgan's pocket-sized white Mercedes convertible, the rusted old Plymouth 2-door that had been the handyman's car. Just inside the entrance, Uncle Morgan was talking to a policeman who shook his head slowly, slowly, in evident sympathy. Morgan Sloat's right arm squeezed the shoulders of a slim young woman in a dress too large for her who had twisted her face into his chest. Mrs. Jerry, Jack knew, seeing that most of her face was obscured by a white handkerchief she had pressed to her eyes. A behatted, rain-coated fireman pushed a mess of twisted metal and plastic, ashes and broken glass into a disorderly heap far past them down the hall. Phil said, "Just sit here for a minute or two, okay, Jackie?" and sprinted toward the entrance. A young Chinese woman sat talking to a policeman on a concrete abutment at the end of the parking lot. Before her lay a crumpled object that took Jack a moment to recognize as a bike. When Jack inhaled, he smelled bitter smoke. 20 minutes later, both his father and Uncle Morgan left the building. Still gripping Mrs. Jerry, Uncle Morgan waved goodbye to the Sawyers. He led the woman around to the passenger door of his tiny car. Jack's father twirled his own car out of the lot and back into the traffic on Sunset. "Is Jerry hurt?" Jack asked. "Some kind of freak accident," his father said. "Electricity, the whole building could have gone up in smoke." "Is Jerry hurt?" Jack repeated. "Poor son of a bitch got hurt so bad he's dead," said his father. Jack and Richard Sloat needed 2 months to really put the story together out of the conversations they overheard. Jack's mother and Richard's housekeeper supplied other details, the housekeeper the goriest. Jerry Bledsoe had come in on a Saturday to try to iron out some of the kinks in the building's security system. If he tampered with the delicate system on a weekday, he was sure to confuse or irritate the tenants with the klaxon alarm whenever he accidentally set it off. The security system was wired into the building's main electrical board, set behind 2 large removable walnut panels on the ground floor. Jerry had set down his tools and lifted off the panels, having already seen that the lot was empty and nobody would jump out of his skin when the alarm went off. Then he went downstairs to the telephone in his basement cubicle and told the local precinct house to ignore any signals from the Sawyer and Sloat address until his next telephone call. When he went back upstairs to tackle the mare's nest of wires coming into the board from all the contact points, a 23-year-old woman named Lorette Chang was just riding her bicycle into the building's lot. She was distributing a leaflet advertising a restaurant which was due to open down the street in 15 days. Miss Chang later told the police that she looked through the glass front door and saw a workman enter the hall from the basement. Just before the workman picked up his screwdriver and touched the wiring panel, she felt the parking lot wobble beneath her feet. It was, she assumed, a mini earthquake. A lifelong resident of Los Angeles, Lorette Chang was untroubled by any seismic event that did not actually knock anything down. She saw Jerry Bledsoe set his feet, so he felt it too, though no one else did, shake his head, then gently insert the tip of the screwdriver into a hive of wires. And then the entry and downstairs corridor of the Sawyer and Sloat building turned into a holocaust. The entire wiring panel turned instantly to a solid rectangular body of flame. Bluish-yellow arcs of what looked like lightning shot out and encased the workman. Electronic horns bawled and bawled. Kawam! Kawam! A ball of fire 6 feet high fell right out of the wall, slammed the already dead Jerry Bledsoe aside, and rolled down the corridor toward the lobby. The transparent front door blew into flying glass and smoking twisted pieces of frame. Lorette Chang dropped her bike and sprinted toward the pay telephone across the street. As she told the fire department the building's address and noticed that her bicycle had been twisted neatly in half by whatever force had burst through the door, Jerry Bledsoe's roasted corpse still swayed upright back and forth before the devastated panel. Thousands of volts poured through his body, twitching it with regular surges, snapping it back and forth in a steady pulse. All the handyman's body hair and most of his clothes had fried off, and his skin had become a cooked, blotchy gray. His eyeglasses, a solidifying lump of brown plastic, covered his nose like a poultice. "Jerry Bledsoe, who plays those changes, Daddy?" Jack made his feet move until he had gone half an hour without seeing another of the little thatched cottages. Unfamiliar stars in unfamiliar patterns lay all over the sky above him. Messages in a language he could not read. Chapter 12. Jack Goes to the Market. He slept that night in a sweetly fragrant Territory's haystack, first burrowing his way in and then turning around so the fresh air could reach him along the tunnel he had made. He listened apprehensively for small scuttering sounds. He had heard or read somewhere that field mice were great haystack fans. If they were in this one, then a great big mouse named Jack Sawyer had scared them into silence. He relaxed, little by little, his left hand tracing the shape of Speedy's bottle. He had plugged the top with a piece of springy moss from a small stream where he had stopped to drink. He supposed it was entirely possible that some of the moss would fall into the bottle, or already had. What a pity. It would spoil the piquant flavor and the delicate bouquet. As he lay in here, warm at last, heavily sleepy, the feeling he was most aware of was relief. As if there had been a dozen 10-pound weights strapped to his back, and some kind soul had undone the buckles and allowed them to fall to the ground. He was in the Territories again, the place which such charming folks as Morgan of Orris, Osmond the Bullwhipper, and Elroy the Amazing Goat Man all called home, the Territories where anything could happen. But the Territories could be good, too. He remembered that from his earliest childhood, when everyone had lived in California and no one had lived anyplace else. The Territories could be good, and it seemed he felt that goodness around him now, as calmly, inarguably sweet as the smell of a haystack, as clear as the smell of the Territory's air. Does a fly or a ladybug feel relief if an unexpected gust of wind comes along and tilts the pitcher plant just enough to allow the drowning insect to fly out? Jack didn't know. But he knew that he was out of Oatley, away from fair weather clubs and old men who wept over their stolen shopping carts, away from the smell of beer and the smell of puke. Most important of all, he was away from Smoky Updike and the Oatley Tap. He thought he might travel in the Territories for a while, after all. And so thinking, fell asleep. He had walked 2, perhaps 3 miles along the western road the following morning, enjoying the sunshine and the good earthy smell of fields almost ready for the harvests of summer's end, when a cart pulled over and a whiskery farmer in what looked like a toga with rough breeches under it pulled up and shouted, "Are you for Market Town, boy?" Jack gaped at him, half in a panic, realizing that the man was not speaking English. Never mind prithee or dost thou go cross-gartered, varlet, it wasn't English at all. There was a woman in a voluminous dress sitting beside the whiskery farmer. She held a boy of perhaps 3 on her lap. She smiled pleasantly enough at Jack and rolled her eyes at her husband. "He's a simpleton, Henry. They're not speaking English. But whatever it is they're speaking, I understand it.
I'm actually thinking in that language, and that's not all I'm seeing in it, or with it, or whatever it is I mean.
Jack realized he had been doing it the last time he had been in the territories, too. Only then he had been too confused to realize it. Things had moved too fast, and everything had seemed strange.
The farmer leaned forward. He smiled, showing teeth which were absolutely horrid.
"Are you a simpleton, laddie?" he asked, not unkindly.
"No," he said, smiling back as best he could, aware that he had not said no, but some territory's word which meant no. When he had flipped, he had changed his speech and his way of thinking, his way of imaging, anyway. He did not have that word in his vocabulary, but understood what he meant just the same, just as he had changed his clothes.
"I'm not simple. It's just that my mother told me to be careful of people I might meet along the road."
Now the farmer's wife smiled.
"Your mother was right," she said. "Are you for the market?"
"Yes," Jack said. "That is, I'm headed up the road, west."
"Climb up in the back, then," Henry the farmer said. "Daylight's wasting. I want to sell what I have if I can and be home again before sunset. Corn's poor, but it's the last of the season. Lucky to have corn in 9 months at all. Someone may buy it."
"Thank you," Jack said, climbing into the back of the low wagon.
Here, dozens of corn were bound with rough hanks of rope and stacked like cordwood. If the corn was poor, then Jack could not imagine what would constitute good corn over here. They were the biggest ears he had ever seen in his life. There were also small stacks of squashes and gourds and things that looked like pumpkins, but they were reddish instead of orange. Jack didn't know what they were, but he suspected they would taste wonderful. His stomach rumbled busily. Since going on the road, he had discovered what hunger was, not as a passing acquaintance, something you felt dimly after school and which could be assuaged with a few cookies and a glass of milk souped up with Nestle's Quick, but as an intimate friend, one that sometimes moved away to a distance, but who rarely left entirely. He was sitting with his back to the front of the wagon, his sandal-clad feet dangling down, almost touching the hard-packed dirt of the western road. There was a lot of traffic this morning, most of it bound for the market, Jack assumed. Every now and then Henry bawled a greeting to someone he knew. Jack was still wondering how those apple-colored pumpkins might taste, and just where his next meal was going to come from anyway, when small hands twined in his hair and gave a brisk tug, brisk enough to make his eyes water. He turned and saw the 3-year-old standing there in his bare feet, a big grin on his face, and a few strands of Jack's hair in each of his hands.
"Jason," his mother cried, but it was in its way an indulgent cry. "Did you see the way he pulled that hair? My, isn't he strong? Jason, that's not nice."
Jason grinned unabashed. It was a big, dopey, sunshiny grin, as sweet in its way as the smell of the haystack in which Jack had spent the night. He couldn't help returning it, and while there had been no politics of calculation in his returning grin, he saw he had made a friend of Henry's wife.
"Sit," Jason said, swaying back and forth with the unconscious movement of a veteran sailor. He was still grinning at Jack.
"Huh?"
"Yap."
"I'm not getting you, Jason."
"Sit, yap!"
"I'm not," and then Jason, who was husky for a 3-year-old, plopped into Jack's lap, still grinning.
"Sit, yap. Oh, yeah, I get it," Jack thought, feeling the dull ache from his testicles spreading up into the pit of his stomach.
"Jason, bad," his mother called back, in that same indulgent but isn't he cute voice. And Jason, who knew who ruled the roost, grinned his dopey, sweetly charming grin. Jack realized that Jason was wet. Very, extremely, indubitably wet.
"Welcome back to the territories, Jacko." And sitting there with the child in his arms and warm wetness slowly soaking through his clothes, Jack began to laugh, his face turned up to the blue, blue sky. A few minutes later, Henry's wife worked her way to where Jack was sitting with the child on his lap and took Jason back.
"Oh, wet, bad baby," she said in her indulgent voice. "Doesn't my Jason wet big," Jack thought, and laughed again. That made Jason laugh, and Mrs. Henry laughed with them.
As she changed Jason, she asked Jack a number of questions, ones he had heard often enough in his own world. But here he would have to be careful. He was a stranger, and there might be hidden trap doors. He heard his father telling Morgan, "A real stranger, if you see what I mean." Jack sensed that the woman's husband was listening closely. He answered her questions with a careful variation of the story, not the one he told when he was applying for a job, but the one he told when someone who had picked him up thumbing got curious. He said he had come from the village of All Hands. Jason's mother had a vague recollection of hearing of the place, but that was all. Had he really come so far, she wanted to know. Jack told her that he had. And where was he going? He told her and the silently listening Henry that he was bound for the village of California. That one she had not heard of, even vaguely, in such stories as the occasional peddler told. Jack was not exactly very surprised, but he was grateful that neither of them exclaimed, "California? Whoever heard of a village named California? Who are you trying to shuck and jive, boy?" In the territories, there had to be lots of places, whole areas as well as villages, of which people who lived in their own little areas had never heard. No power poles, no electricity, no movies, no cable TV to tell them how wonderful things were in Malibu or Sarasota. No territory's version of Ma Bell, advertising that a 3-minute call to the outpost after 5 p.m. cost only $5.83, plus tax. Rates may be higher on God Pounder's Eve and some other holidays. They live in a mystery, he thought. When you live in a mystery, you don't question a village simply because you've never heard of it. California doesn't sound any wilder than a place named All Hands. Nor did they question. He told them that his father had died the year before and that his mother was quite ill. He thought of adding that the Queen's repossession men had come in the middle of the night and taken away their donkey, grinned, and decided that maybe he ought to leave that part out. His mother had given him what money she could, except the word that came out in the strange language wasn't really money, it was something like sticks, and had sent him off to the village of California to stay with his Aunt Helen. "These are hard times," Mrs. Henry said, holding Jason, now changed, more closely to her. "All Hands is near the Summer Palace, isn't it, boy?" It was the first time Henry had spoken since inviting Jack aboard. "Yes," Jack said. "That is fairly near. I mean, you never said what your father died of." Now he had turned his head. His gaze was narrow and assessing, the former kindness gone. It had been blown out of his eyes like candle flames in a wind. Yes, there were trapdoors here. "Was he ill?" Mrs. Henry asked. "So much illness these days. Pox, plague, hard times." For a wild moment, Jack thought of saying, "No, he wasn't ill, Mrs. Henry. He took a lot of volts, my dad. You see, he went off one Saturday to do some work, and he left Mrs. Jerry and all the little Jerrys, including me, back at home. This was when we all lived in a hole in the baseboard, and nobody lived anywhere else, you see. And do you know what? He stuck his screwdriver into a bunch of wires, and Mrs. Feeney, she works over at Richard Sloat's house, she heard Uncle Morgan talking on the phone, and he said the electricity came out, all of the electricity, and it cooked him. It cooked him so bad that his glasses melted all over his nose. Only you don't know about glasses because you don't have them here. No glasses, no electricity, no midnight blue, no airplanes. Don't end up like Mrs. Jerry, Mrs. Henry. Don't never mind, was he ill?" the whiskered farmer said. "Was he political?" Jack looked at him. His mouth was working, but no sounds came out. He didn't know what to say. There were too many trap doors. Henry nodded as if he had answered. "Jump down, laddie. Market's just over the next rise. I reckon you can ankle it from here, can't you?" "Yes," Jack said. "I reckon I can." Mrs. Henry looked confused, but she was now holding Jason away from Jack, as if he might have some contagious disease. The farmer, still looking back over his shoulder, smiled a bit ruefully. "I'm sorry. You seem a nice enough lad, but we're simple people here. Whatever's going on back yonder by the sea is something for great lords to settle. Either the queen will die or she won't. And, of course, someday she must. God pounds all his nails sooner or later, and what happens to little people when they meddle into the affairs of the great is that they get hurt.
My father... I don't want to know about your father, Henry said sharply. His wife scrambled away from Jack, still holding Jason to her bosom. Good man or bad, I don't know and I don't want to know. All I know is that he's a dead man. I don't think you lied about that, and that his son has been sleeping rough and has all the smell of being on the dodge. The son doesn't talk as if he comes from any of these parts, so climb down. I've a son of my own, as you see.
Jack got down, sorry for the fear in the young woman's face, fear he had put there. The farmer was right. Little people had no business meddling in the affairs of the great. Not if they were smart.
Chapter 13. The Man in the Sky.
It was a shock to discover that the money he had worked so hard to get literally had turned into sticks. They looked like toy snakes made by an inept craftsman. The shock lasted only for a moment, however, and he laughed ruefully at himself. The sticks were money, of course. When he came over here, everything changed. Silver dollar to griffin coin, shirt to jerkin, English to territory speech, and good old American money to, well, to jointed sticks. He had flipped over with about $22 in all, and he guessed that he had exactly the same amount in territory's money, although he had counted 14 joints on one of the money sticks and better than 20 on the other. The problem wasn't so much money as cost. He had very little idea of what was cheap and what was dear, and as he walked through the market, Jack felt like a contestant on the new Price is Right. Only if he flubbed it here, there wouldn't be any consolation prize and a clap on the back from Bob Barker. If he flubbed it here, they might... Well, he didn't know for sure what they might do. Run him out for sure. Hurt him? Rough him up? Maybe. Kill him? Probably not, but it was impossible to be absolutely certain. They were little people. They were not political. And he was a stranger. Jack walked slowly from one end of the loud and busy market day throng to the other, wrestling with the problem. It now centered mostly in his stomach. He was dreadfully hungry. Once he saw Henry dickering with a man who had goats to sell. Mrs. Henry stood near him, but a bit behind, giving the men room to trade. Her back was to Jack, but she had the baby hoisted in her arms. Jason, one of the little Henrys, Jack thought. But Jason saw him. The baby waved one chubby hand at Jack, and Jack turned away quickly, putting as much crowd as he could between himself and the Henrys. Everywhere was the smell of roasting meat, it seemed. He saw vendors slowly turning joints of beef over charcoal fires, both small and ambitious. He saw apprentices laying thick slices of what looked like pork on slabs of homemade bread and taking them to the buyers. They looked like runners at an auction. Most of the buyers were farmers like Henry, and it appeared that they also called for food the way people entered a bid at an auction. They simply raised one of their hands imperiously, the fingers splayed out. Jack watched several of these transactions closely, and in every case the medium of exchange was the jointed sticks. But how many knuckles would be enough, he wondered. Not that it mattered. He had to eat, whether the transaction marked him as a stranger or not. He passed a mime show, barely giving it a glance, although the large audience that had gathered, women and children most of them, roared with appreciative laughter and applauded. He moved toward a stall with canvas sides, where a big man with tattoos on his slabbed biceps stood on one side of a trench of smoldering charcoal in the earth. An iron spit about 7 feet long ran over the charcoal. A sweating, dirty boy stood at each end. 5 large roasts were impaled along the length of the spit, and the boys were turning them in unison. Fine meats, the big man was droning. Fine meats, buy my fine meats here, fine meats right here. In an aside to the boy closest to him, put your back into it, God pound you. Then back to his droning, huckstering cry. A farmer, passing with his adolescent daughter, raised his hand and then pointed at the joint of meat second from the left. The boys stopped turning the spit long enough for their boss to hack a slab from the roast and put it on a chunk of bread. One of them ran with it to the farmer, who produced one of the jointed sticks. Watching closely, Jack saw him break off 2 knuckles of wood and hand them to the boy.
As the boy ran back to the stall, the customer pocketed his money stick with the absent but careful gesture of any man repocketing his change, took a gigantic bite of his open-faced sandwich, and handed the rest to his daughter, whose first chop was almost as enthusiastic as her father's. Jack's stomach boinged and goinged. He had seen what he had to see, he hoped.
"Fine meats, fine meats, fine..."
The big man broke off and looked down at Jack, his beetling brows drawing together over eyes that were small but not entirely stupid.
"I hear the song your stomach is singing, friend. If you have money, I'll take your trade and bless you to God in my prayers tonight. If you haven't, then get your stupid sheep's face out of here and go to the devil."
Both boys laughed, although they were obviously tired. They laughed as if they had no control over the sounds they were making. But the maddening smell of the slowly cooking meat would not let him leave. He held out the shorter of his jointed sticks and pointed to the roast which was second from the left. He didn't speak. It seemed safer not to. The vendor grunted, produced his crude knife from his wide belt again, and cut a slice. It was a smaller slice than the one he had cut the farmer, Jack observed, but his stomach had no business with such matters. It was rumbling crazily in anticipation. The vendor slapped the meat on bread and brought it over himself instead of handing it to either of the boys. He took Jack's money stick. Instead of two knuckles, he broke off three. His mother's voice, sourly amused, spoke up in his mind. "Congratulations, Jacko. You've just been screwed." The vendor was looking at him, grinning around a mouthful of wretched, blackish teeth, daring him to say anything, to protest in any way.
"You ought to just be grateful I only took three knuckles instead of all 14 of them. I could have, you know. You might as well have a sign hung around your neck, boy. I am a stranger here and on my own. So tell me, sheep's face, do you want to make an issue of it?"
What he wanted didn't matter. He obviously couldn't make an issue of it. But he felt that thin, impotent anger again.
"Go on," the vendor said, tiring of him. He flapped a big hand in Jack's face. His fingers were scarred, and there was blood under his nails. "You got your food? Now get out of here."
Jack thought, "I could show you a flashlight, and you'd run like all the devils of hell were after you. Show you an airplane, and you'd probably go crazy. You're maybe not as tough as you think, chum." He smiled. Perhaps it was something in his smile that the meat vendor didn't like, because he drew away from Jack, his face momentarily uneasy. Then his brows beetled together again.
"Get out, I said," he roared. "Get out, God pound you!"
And this time Jack went. The meat was delicious. Jack gobbled it and the bread it sat on, and then unselfconsciously licked the juice from his palms as he strolled along. The meat did taste like pork, and yet it didn't. It was somehow richer, tangier than pork. Whatever it was, it filled the hole in the middle of him with authority. Jack thought he could take it to school in bag lunches for 1,000 years. Now that he had managed to shut his belly up, for a little while anyway, he was able to look about himself with more interest, and although he didn't know it, he had finally begun to blend into the crowd. Now he was only one more rube from the country come to the market town, walking slowly between the stalls, trying to gawk in every direction at once. Hucksters recognized him, but only as one more potential mark among many. They yelled and beckoned at him, and as he passed by, they yelled and beckoned at whoever happened to be behind him, man, woman, or child. Jack gaped, frankly, at the wares scattered all around him, wares both wonderful and strange. And amidst all the others staring at them, he ceased to be a stranger himself. Perhaps because he had given up his effort to seem blasé in a place where no one acted blasé. They laughed, they argued, they haggled, but no one seemed bored. The market town reminded him of the Queen's Pavilion without the air of strained tension and too hectic gaiety. There was the same absurdly rich mingle of smells dominated by roasting meat and animal ordure, the same brightly dressed crowds, although even the most brightly dressed people Jack saw couldn't hold a candle to some of the dandies he had seen inside the pavilion, the same unsettling but somehow exhilarating juxtaposition of the perfectly normal cheek by jowl with the extravagantly strange. He stopped at a stall where a man was selling carpets with the Queen's portrait woven into them. Jack suddenly thought of Hank Scoffler's mom and smiled. Hank was one of the kids Jack and Richard Sloat had hung around with in L.A. Mrs. Scoffler had a thing for the most garish decorations Jack had ever seen. And God, wouldn't she have loved these rugs, with the image of Laura DeLoessian, her hair done up in a high, regal coronet of braids woven into them, better than her velvet paintings of Alaskan stags, or the ceramic diorama of the Last Supper behind the bar in the Scoffler living room. Then the face, woven into the rugs, seemed to change, even as he looked at it. The face of the Queen was gone, and it was his mother's face he saw, repeated over and over and over, her eyes too dark, her skin much too white. Homesickness surprised Jack again. It rushed through his mind in a wave, and he called out for her in his heart. "Mom! Hey, Mom! Jesus, what am I doing here, Mom?" Wondering with a lover's longing intensity what she was doing now, right this minute. Sitting at the window, smoking, looking out at the ocean, a book open beside her, watching TV, at a movie, sleeping, dying. "Dead," an evil voice added before he could stop it. "Dead, Jack? Already dead? Stop it." He felt the burning sting of tears. "Why so sad, my little lad?" He looked up, startled, and saw the rug salesman looking at him. He was as big as the meat vendor, and his arms were also tattooed, but his smile was open and sunny. There was no meanness in it. That was a big difference. "It's nothing," Jack said.
"If it's nothing makes you look like that, you ought to be thinking of something, my son, my son."
"I looked that bad, did I?" Jack asked, smiling a little. He had also grown unself-conscious about his speech, at least for the moment, and perhaps that was why the rug salesman heard nothing odd or off-rhythm in it.
"Laddie, you looked as if you only had one friend left on this side of the moon, and you just saw the wild white wolf come out of the north and gobble him down with a silver spoon."
Jack smiled a little. The rug salesman turned away and took something from a smaller display to the right of the largest rug. It was oval and had a short handle. As he turned it over, the sun flashed across it. It was a mirror. To Jack, it looked small and cheap, the sort of thing you might get for knocking over all three wooden milk bottles in a carnival game.
"Here, laddie," the rug salesman said, "take a look and see if I'm not right."
Jack looked into the mirror and gaped. For a moment so stunned, he thought his heart must have forgotten to beat. It was him, but he looked like something from Pleasure Island in the Disney version of Pinocchio, where too much pool shooting and cigar smoking had turned boys into donkeys. His eyes, normally as blue and round as an Anglo-Saxon heritage could make them, had gone brown and almond-shaped. His hair, coarsely matted and falling across the middle of his forehead, had a definite mane-like look. He raised one hand to brush it away and touched only bare skin. In the mirror, his fingers seemed to fade right through the hair. He heard the vendor laugh, pleased. Most amazing of all, long jackass ears dangled down to below his jawline. As he stared, one of them twitched. He thought suddenly, "I had one of these." And on the heels of that, "In the daydreams I had one of these. Back in the regular world, it was... He could have been no more than 4. In the regular world, he had stopped thinking of it as the real world without even noticing, it had been a great big glass marble with a rosy center. One day, while he was playing with it, it had rolled down the cement path in front of their house, and before he could catch it, it had fallen down a sewer grate. It had been gone, forever, he had thought then, sitting on the curb with his face propped on his dirty hands and weeping. But it wasn't. Here was that old toy rediscovered, just as wonderful now as it had been when he was 3 or 4. He grinned, delighted. The image changed, and Jack the Jackass became Jack the Cat, his face wise and secret with amusement. His eyes went from donkey brown to tomcat green. Now pert little gray-furred ears cocked alertly where the droopy donkey ears had dangled.
Better, the vendor said. Better, my son. I like to see a happy boy. A happy boy is a healthy boy, and a healthy boy finds his way in the world. Book of Good Farming says that, and if it doesn't, it should. I may just scratch it in my copy if I ever scratch up enough scratch from my pumpkin patch to buy a copy someday. Want the glass?
Yes, Jack cried. Yeah, great. He groped for his sticks. Frugality was forgotten. How much?
The vendor frowned and looked around swiftly to see if they were being watched.
Put it away, my son. Tuck it down deep, that's the way. You show your scratch, you're apt to lose the batch. Dips abound on market ground.
What?
Never mind. No charge. Take it. Half of 'em get broken in the back of my wagon when I drag 'em back to my store come 10 months. Mothers bring their little uns over and they try it, but they don't buy it.
Well, at least you don't deny it, Jack said. The vendor looked at him with some surprise, and then they both burst out laughing.
A happy boy with a snappy mouth, the vendor said. Come see me when you're older and bolder, my son. We'll take your mouth and head south and treble what we peddle.
Jack giggled. This guy was better than a rap record by the Sugar Hill Gang.
Thanks, he said. A large, improbable grin had appeared on the chops of the cat in the mirror.
Thanks very much.
Thank me to God, the vendor said. Then, as an afterthought, and watch your wad.
Jack moved on, tucking the mirror toy carefully into his jerkin next to Speedy's bottle. And every few minutes he checked to make sure his sticks were still there. He guessed he knew what dips were, after all. Two stalls down from the booth of the rhyming rug vendor, a depraved-looking man with a patch askew over one eye and the smell of strong drink about him, was trying to sell a farmer a large rooster. He was telling the farmer that if he bought this rooster and put it in with his hens, the farmer would have nothing but double yokers for the next 12 months. Jack, however, had neither eyes for the rooster nor ears for the salesman's pitch. He joined a crowd of children who were staring at the one-eyed man's star attraction. This was a parrot in a large wicker cage. It was almost as tall as the youngest children in the group, and it was as smoothly, darkly green as a Heineken beer bottle. Its eyes were a brilliant gold. Its four eyes. Like the pony he had seen in the pavilion stables, the parrot had two heads. It gripped its perch with its big yellow feet and looked placidly in two directions at once, its two tufted crowns almost touching. The parrot was talking to itself to the amusement of the children, but even in his amazement, Jack noted that while they were paying close attention to the parrot, they seemed neither stunned nor even very wondering. They weren't like kids seeing their first movie, sitting stupefied in their seats and all eyes. They were more like kids getting their regular Saturday morning cartoon fix. This was a wonder, yes, but not a wholly new one. And to whom do wonders pall more rapidly than the very young?
Brock, how high is up? Easthead inquired.
As low, Westhead responded, and the children giggled.
Crack, what's the great truth of noblemen? Easthead now asked.
That a king will be a king all his life, but once a night's enough for any man, Westhead replied pertly.
Jack smiled, and several of the older children laughed, but the younger ones only looked puzzled.
And what's in Mrs. Pratt's cupboard? Easthead now posed. A sight no man shall see, Westhead rejoined,
and although Jack was mystified, the children went into gales of laughter. The parrot solemnly shifted its talons on its perch and made droppings into the straw below it.
And what frightened Alan Destry to death in the night? He saw his wife, Grok, getting out of the bath.
The farmer was now walking away, and the one-eyed salesman still had charge of the rooster. He rounded furiously on the children.
Get out of here! Get out of here before I kick your asses square!
The children scattered. Jack went with them, sparing a last bemused look over his shoulder at the wonderful parrot. At another stall, he gave up 2 knuckles of wood for an apple and a dipper of milk, the sweetest, richest milk he had ever tasted. Jack thought that if they had milk like that back at home, Nestle's and Hershey's would go bankrupt in a week. He was just finishing the milk when he saw the Henry family moving slowly in his direction. He handed the dipper back to the woman in the stall, who poured the lees thriftily back into the large wooden cask beside her. Jack hurried on, wiping a milk mustache from his upper lip, and hoping uneasily that no one who had drunk from the dipper before him had had leprosy or herpes or anything like that. But he somehow didn't think such awful things even existed over here. He walked up the market town's main thoroughfare, past the mimers, past two fat women selling pots and pans, territory's Tupperware, Jack thought, and grinned, past that wonderful two-headed parrot. Its one-eyed owner was now drinking quite openly from a clay bottle, reeling wildly from one end of his booth to the other, holding the dazed-looking rooster by the neck and yelling truculently at passers-by. Jack saw the man's scrawny right arm was caked with yellowish-white guano and grimaced. Past an open area where farmers were gathered, he paused there for a moment, curious. Many of the farmers were smoking clay pipes, and Jack saw several clay bottles, much the same as the one the bird salesman had been brandishing, go from hand to hand. In a long grassy field, men were hitching stones behind large shaggy horses with lowered heads and mild, stupid eyes. Jack passed the rug stall. The vendor saw him and raised a hand. Jack raised one in turn and thought of calling, "Use it, my man, but don't abuse it." He decided he better not. He was suddenly aware that he felt blue. That feeling of strangeness, of being an outsider, had fallen over him again. He reached the crossroads. The way going north and south was little more than a country lane. The western road was much wider. "Old Travelin' Jack," he thought, and tried to smile. He straightened his shoulders and heard Speedy's bottle clink lightly against the mirror. "Here goes old Travelin' Jack along the territory's version of Interstate 90. Feats don't fail me now." He set off again, and soon that great, dreaming land swallowed him. About 4 hours later, in the middle of the afternoon, Jack sat down in the tall grass by the side of the road and watched as a number of men, from this distance they looked little bigger than bugs, climbed a tall, rickety-looking tower. He had chosen this place to rest and eat his apple because it was here that the western road seemed to make its closest approach to that tower. It was still at least 3 miles away, and perhaps much more than that. The almost supernatural clarity of the air made distances extremely hard to judge. But it had been in Jack's view for an hour or more. Jack ate his apple, rested his tired feet, and wondered what that tower could be, standing out there all by itself in a field of rolling grass. And, of course, he wondered why those men should be climbing it. The wind had blown quite steadily ever since he had left the market town, and the tower was downwind of Jack, but whenever it died away for a minute, Jack could hear them calling to each other, and laughing. There was a lot of laughing going on. Some 5 miles west of the market, Jack had walked through a village, if your definition of a village stretched to cover 5 tiny houses and 1 store that had obviously been closed for a long time. Those had been the last human habitations he had seen between then and now. Just before glimpsing the tower, he had been wondering if he had already come to the outposts without even knowing it. He remembered well enough what Captain Farron had said. "Beyond the outposts, the western road goes into nowhere, or into hell. I've heard it said that God himself never ventures beyond the outposts." Jack shivered a little. But he really didn't believe he had come so far. Certainly there was none of the steadily deepening unease he had been feeling before he floundered into the living trees in his effort to get away from Morgan's diligence, the living trees which now seemed like a hideous prologue to all the time he had spent in Oatley. Indeed, the good emotions he had felt from the time he woke up warm and rested inside the haystack until the time Henry the farmer had invited him to jump down from his wagon had now resurfaced. That feeling that the territories, in spite of whatever evil they might harbor, were fundamentally good, and that he could be a part of this place any time he wanted, that he was really no stranger at all. He had come to realize that he was part of the territories for long periods of time. A strange thought had come to him as he swung easily along the western road, a thought which came half in English and half in whatever the territory's language was. When I'm having a dream, the only time I really know it's a dream is when I'm starting to wake up. If I'm dreaming and just wake up all at once, if the alarm clock goes off or something, then I'm the most surprised guy alive. At first, it's the waking that seems like a dream, and I'm no stranger over here when the dream gets deep. Is that what I mean? No, but it's getting close. I bet my dad dreamed deep a lot, and I'll bet Uncle Morgan almost never does. He had decided he would take a swig out of Speedy's bottle and flip back the first time he saw anything that might be dangerous, even if he saw anything scary. Otherwise, he would walk all day over here before returning to New York. In fact, he might have been tempted to spend the night in the territories if he'd had anything to eat beyond the one apple, but he didn't, and along the wide, deserted dirt track of the western road, there was not a 7-Eleven or a stop-and-go in sight. The old trees which had surrounded the crossroads and the market town had given way to open grassland on either side once Jack got past the final small settlement. He began to feel that he was walking along an endless causeway which crossed the middle of a limitless ocean. He traveled the western road alone that day under a sky that was bright and sunny, but cool, late September now, of course it's cool, he thought, except the word which came to mind was not September, but a territory's word which really did translate better as 9 months. No pedestrians passed him, no wagons either loaded or empty. The wind blew pretty steadily, sighing through the ocean of grasses with a low sound that was both autumnal and lonely. Great ripples ran across the grasses before that wind. If asked, "How do you feel, Jack?" the boy would have responded, "Pretty good, thanks. Cheerful." Cheerful is the word which would have come into his mind as he hiked through those empty grasslands. Rapture was a word he associated most easily with the pop hit of the same name by the rock group Blondie, and he would have been astounded if told he had wept several times as he stood watching those great ripples chase each other toward the horizon, drinking in a sight that only a very few American children of his time had ever seen, huge, empty tracts of land under a blue sky of dizzying width and breadth, and yes, even depth. It was a sky unmarked by either jet contrails across its dome or smutty bands of smog at any of its lower edges. Jack was having an experience of remarkable sensory impact, seeing and hearing and smelling things which were brand new to him, while other sensory input to which he had grown utterly accustomed was missing for the first time. In many ways, he was a remarkably sophisticated child, brought up in a Los Angeles family where his father had been an agent and his mother a movie actress. It would have been odder if he had been naive. But he was still just a child, sophisticated or not, and that was undeniably his gain, at least in a situation such as this. That lonely day's journey across the grasslands would surely have produced sensory overload, perhaps even a pervasive sense of madness and hallucination in an adult. An adult would have been scrabbling for Speedy's bottle, probably with fingers too shaky to grasp it very successfully, an hour west of the market town, maybe less. In Jack's case, the wallop passed almost completely through his conscious mind and into his subconscious. So when he blissed out entirely and began to weep, he was really unaware of the tears, except as a momentary doubling of vision which he attributed to sweat, and thought only, "Geez, I feel good. It should feel spooky out here with no one around, but it doesn't." That was how Jack came to think of his rapture as no more than a good, cheerful feeling as he walked alone up the western road, with his shadow gradually growing longer behind him. It did not occur to him that part of his emotional radiance might stem from the fact that hardly less than 12 hours before, he had been a prisoner of Updike's Oatly Tap. The blood blisters from the last keg to land on his fingers were still fresh. That hardly less than 12 hours ago, he had escaped, barely, some sort of murdering beast that he had begun to think of as a were-goat, that for the first time in his life, he was on a wide, open road that was utterly deserted except for him. There was not a Coca-Cola sign anywhere in view, or a Budweiser billboard showing the world-famous Clydesdales. No ubiquitous wires ran beside the road on either side, or crisscrossed above it, as had been the case on every road Jack Sawyer had ever traveled in his entire life. There was not so much as even the distant rolling sound of an airplane, let alone the rolling thunder of the 747s on their final approaches to LAX, or the F-111s that were always blasting off from the Portsmouth Naval Air Station, and then cracking the air over the Alhambra like Osman's whip as they headed out over the Atlantic. There was only the sound of his feet on the road and the clean ebb and flow of his own respiration. "Geez, I feel good," Jack thought, wiping absently at his eyes, and defined it all as cheerful. Now there was this tower to look at and wonder about. "Boy, you'd never get me up on that thing," Jack thought. He had gnawed the apple right down to the core, and without thinking about what he was doing or even taking his eyes off the tower, he dug a hole in the tough, springy earth with his fingers and buried the apple core in it. The tower seemed made of barn boards, and Jack guessed it had to be at least 500 feet high. It appeared to be a big hollow square, the boards rising on all sides in X after X. There was a platform on top, and Jack, squinting, could see a number of men strolling around up there. Wind pushed by him in a gentle gust as he sat at the side of the road, his knees against his chest and his arms wrapped around them. Another of those grassy ripples ran away in the direction of the tower. Jack imagined the way that rickety thing must be swaying and felt his stomach turn over. "Never get me up there," he thought, "not for $1 million." And then the thing he had been afraid might happen since the moment he had observed that there were men on the tower now did happen. One of them fell. Jack came to his feet. His face wore the dismayed, slack-jawed expression of anyone who has ever been present at a circus performance where some dangerous trick has gone wrong. The tumbler who falls badly and lies in a huddled heap. The aerialist who misses her grip and bounces off the net with a thud. The human pyramid that unexpectedly collapses, spilling bodies into a heap. "Oh, shit! Oh, cripes! Oh!" Jack's eyes suddenly widened. For a moment his jaw sagged even farther, until it was almost lying on his breastbone, in fact. And then it came up, and his mouth spread in a dazed, unbelieving grin. The man hadn't fallen from the tower, nor had he been blown off it. There were tongue-like protrusions on two sides of the platform. They looked like diving boards. And the man had simply walked out to the end of one of these and jumped off. Halfway down, something began to unfurl. A parachute, Jack thought, but it would never have time to open. Only it hadn't been a parachute. It was wings. The man's fall slowed, and then stopped completely while he was still some 50 feet above the high field grass. Then it reversed itself. The man was now flying upward and outward, the wings going up so high they almost touched, like the crowns on the heads of that Henny Youngman parrot, and then driving downward again with immense power, like the arms of a swimmer in a finishing sprint. "Oh, wow," Jack thought, driven back to the dumbest cliché he knew by his total, utter amazement. This topped everything. This was an utter pisser. "Oh, wow, look at that. Oh, wow." Now a second man leaped from the diving board at the top of the tower. Now a third. Now a fourth. In less than 5 minutes, there must have been 50 men in the air, flying complicated but discernible patterns. Out from the tower, describe a figure eight, back over the tower and out to the other side, another figure eight, back to the tower, alight on the platform, do it all again. They spun and danced and crisscrossed in the air. Jack began to laugh with delight. It was a little like watching the water ballets in those corny old Esther Williams movies. Those swimmers, Esther Williams herself most of all, of course, always made it look easy, as if you yourself could dip and swirl like that, or as if you and a few of your friends could easily come off the opposite sides of the diving board in timed choreography, making a kind of human fountain. But there was a difference.
The men flying out there did not give that sense of effortlessness. They seemed to be expending prodigious amounts of energy to stay in the air, and Jack felt with sudden certainty that it hurt, the way some of the calisthenics in phys ed, leg lifts, or halfway sit-ups, for instance, hurt. "No pain, no gain," Coach would roar if someone had the nerve to complain. And now something else occurred to him. The time his mother had taken him with her to see her friend Myrna, who was a real ballet dancer, practicing in the loft of a dance studio on Lower Wilshire Boulevard. Myrna was part of a ballet troupe, and Jack had seen her and the other dancers perform. His mother often made him go with her, and it was mostly boring stuff like church or sunrise semester on TV. But he had never seen Myrna in practice, never that close up. He had been impressed and a little frightened by the contrast between seeing ballet on stage, where everyone seemed to either glide or mince effortlessly on the tips of their points, and seeing it from less than 5 feet away, with harsh daylight pouring in the floor-to-ceiling windows and no music, only the choreographer rhythmically clapping his hands and yelling harsh criticisms. No praise, only criticisms. Their faces ran with sweat, their leotards were wet with sweat, the room, as large and airy as it was, stank of sweat. Sleek muscles trembled and fluttered on the nervous edge of exhaustion. Corded tendons stood out like insulated cables. Throbbing veins popped out on foreheads and necks. Except for the choreographer's clapping and angry, hectoring shouts, the only sounds were the thrup-thud of ballet dancers on point moving across the floor and harsh, agonized panting for breath. Jack had suddenly realized that these dancers were not just earning a living, they were killing themselves. Most of all, he remembered their expressions, all that exhausted concentration, all that pain. But transcending the pain, or at least creeping around its edges, he had seen joy. Joy was unmistakably what that look was, and it had scared Jack because it had seemed inexplicable. What kind of person could get off by subjecting himself or herself to such steady, throbbing, excruciating pain? And pain that he was seeing here, he thought. Were they actual winged men like the bird people in the old Flash Gordon serials? Or were the wings more in the Icarus and Daedalus line, something that you strapped on? Jack found that it didn't really matter, at least not to him. Joy. They live in a mystery. These people live in a mystery. It's joy that holds them up. That was what mattered. It was joy that held them up, no matter if the wings grew out of their backs or were somehow held on with buckles and clamps. Because what he saw, even from this distance, was the same sort of effort he had seen in the loft on Lower Wilshire that day. All that profligate investment of energy to effect a splendid momentary reversal of natural law. That such a reversal should demand so much and last such a short time was terrible. That people would go for it anyway was both terrible and wonderful. "And it's all just a game," he thought. And suddenly felt sure of it. A game, or maybe not even that, maybe it was only practice for a game, the way that all the sweat and trembling exhaustion in the Wilshire loft that day had just been practice. Practice for a show that only a few people would probably care to attend, and which would probably close quickly. Joy, he thought again, standing now, his face turned up to look at the flying men in the distance, the wind spilling his hair across his forehead. His time of innocence was fast approaching its end, and if pressed, even Jack would have reluctantly agreed that he felt such an end approaching. A boy couldn't go on the road for long, couldn't go through many experiences, such as the one he had gone through in Oatley, and expect to remain an innocent. But in those moments, as he stood looking into the sky, innocence seemed to surround him, like the young fisherman during his brief moment of epiphany in the Elizabeth Bishop poem. Everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. Joy. Damn, but that's a cheerful little word. Feeling better than he had since all of this began, and only God knew just how long ago that had been, Jack set off along the western road again. His step light, his face wreathed in that same silly, splendid grin. Every now and then he looked back over his shoulder, and he was able to see the flyers for a very long time. The territory's air was so clear it almost seemed to magnify. And even after he could no longer see them, that feeling of joy remained, like a rainbow inside his head. When the sun began to go down, Jack realized he was putting off his return to the other world, to the American territories, and not just because of how terrible the magic juice tasted, either. He was putting it off because he didn't want to leave here. A streamlet had flowed out of the grasslands, where small groves of trees had again begun to appear, billowy trees with oddly flat tops like eucalyptus trees, and had hooked a right so that it flowed along beside the road. Farther off, to the right and ahead, was a huge body of water. It was so huge, in fact, that until the last hour or so, Jack had thought it was a patch of sky that somehow had a slightly bluer color than the rest. But it wasn't sky, it was a lake. A great lake, he thought, smiling at the pun. He guessed that in the other world that would be Lake Ontario. He felt good. He was headed in the right direction, maybe a little too far north, but he had no doubt that the western road would bend away from that direction soon enough. That feeling of almost manic joy, what he had defined as cheerfulness, had mellowed to a lovely sort of calm serenity, a feeling that seemed as clear as the territory's air. Only one thing marred his good feeling, and that was the memory 666, Jack was six, of Jerry Bledsoe. Why had his mind given him such a hard time about coughing that memory up? No, not the memory, the two memories. First me and Richard hearing Mrs. Feeney telling her sister that the electricity came out and cooked him, that it melted his glasses all over his nose, that she heard Mr. Sloat talking on the phone and he said so, and then being behind the couch, not really meaning to snoop or eavesdrop, and hearing my dad say everything has consequences and some of those consequences might be on the uncomfortable side. And something surely made Jerry Bledsoe uncomfortable, didn't it? When your glasses end up melting all over your nose, I'd say you'd been through something mildly uncomfortable, yes. Jack stopped. Stopped dead. What are you trying to say? You know what I'm trying to say, Jack. Your father was gone that day. He and Morgan both. They were over here. Where over here? I think they were at the same spot over here where their building is in California, over in the American territories. And they did something, or one of them did. Maybe something big, maybe no more than tossing a rock or burying an apple core in the dirt, and it somehow, it echoed over there. It echoed over there, and it killed Jerry Bledsoe. Jack shivered. Oh, yes. He supposed he knew why it had taken his mind so long to cough up the memory, the toy taxi, the murmur of the men's voices, Dexter Gordon blowing his horn. It hadn't wanted to cough it up. Because who plays those changes, Daddy? It suggested that just by being over here, he could be doing something terrible in the other world. Starting World War III? No, probably not. He hadn't assassinated any kings lately, young or old. But how much had it taken to set up the echo which had fried Jerry Bledsoe? Had Uncle Morgan shot Jerry's twinner, if Jerry had had one? Tried to sell some territory's bigwig on the concept of electricity? Or had it been just some little thing, something no more earth-shattering than buying a chunk of meat in a rural market town? Who played those changes? What played those changes? A nice flood, a sweet fire. Suddenly Jack's mouth was as dry as salt. He crossed to the little stream by the side of the road, dropped to his knees, and put a hand down to scoop up water. His hand froze suddenly. The smooth-running stream had taken on the colors of the coming sunset. But these colors suddenly suffused with red, so that it seemed to be a stream of blood rather than water running beside the road. Then it went black. A moment later it had become transparent, and Jack saw a little mewling sound escaped him as he saw Morgan's diligence roaring along the western road, pulled by its foaming baker's dozen of black-plumed horses. Jack saw with almost swooning terror that the driver, sitting up high in the peak seat, his booted feet on the splashboard and a ceaselessly cracking whip in one hand, was Elroy. But it was not a hand at all that held that whip. It was some sort of hoof. Elroy was driving that nightmare coach, Elroy grinning with a mouth that was filled with dead fangs, Elroy who just couldn't wait to find Jack Sawyer again and split open Jack Sawyer's belly and pull out Jack Sawyer's intestines. Jack knelt before the stream, eyes bulging, mouth quivering with dismay and horror. He had seen one final thing in this vision, not a large thing, no, but by implication it was the most frightful thing of all. The eyes of the horses seemed to glow. They seemed to glow because they were full of light, full of the sunset. The Diligence was traveling west along this same road, and it was after him. Crawling, not sure he could stand even if he had to, Jack retreated from the stream and lurched clumsily out into the road. He fell flat in the dust, Speedy's bottle and the mirror the rug salesman had given him digging into his guts. He turned his head sideways so that his right cheek and ear were pressed tightly against the surface of the western road. He could feel the steady rumble in the hard, dry earth. It was distant, but coming closer. Elroy up on top, Morgan inside. Morgan Sloat, Morgan of Oris. Didn't matter, both were one. He broke the hypnotic effect of that rumbling in the earth with an effort and got up again. He took Speedy's bottle, the same over here in the territories as in the USA, out of his jerkin, and pulled as much as the moss plug out of the neck as he could, never minding the shower of particles into the little bit of liquid remaining, no more than a couple of inches now. He looked nervously to his left, as if expecting to see the black Diligence appear at the horizon, the sunset-filled eyes of the horses glowing like weird lanterns. Of course, he saw nothing. Horizons were closer over here in the territories, as he had already noticed, and sounds traveled farther. Morgan's Diligence had to be 10 miles to the east, maybe as much as 20. Still right on top of me, Jack thought, and raised the bottle to his lips. A bare second before he drank from it, his mind shouted, "Hey, wait a minute, dummy, you want to get killed?" He would look cute, wouldn't he, standing in the middle of the western road and then flipping back into the other world in the middle of some road over there, maybe getting run down by a highballing semi or a UPS truck. Jack shambled over to the side of the road and then walked 10 or 20 paces into the thigh-high grass for good measure. He took one final deep breath, inhaling the sweet smell of this place, groping for that feeling of serenity, that feeling of rainbow. "Gotta try and remember how that felt," he thought. "I may need it, and I may not get back here for a long time." He looked out at the grasslands, darkening now as night stole over them from the east. The wind gusted, chilly now, but still fragrant, tossing his hair. It was getting shaggy now as it tossed the grass. "You ready, Jacko?" Jack closed his eyes and steeled himself against the awful taste and the vomiting that was apt to follow. "Banzai," he whispered, and drank. Chapter 14. Buddy Parkins. He vomited up a thin, purple drool, his face only inches from the grass covering the long slope down to a four-lane highway, shook his head and rocked backward onto his knees so that only his back was exposed to the heavy gray sky. The world, this world, stank. Jack pushed himself backward away from the threads of puke settling over the blades of grass, and the stench altered but did not diminish. Gasoline, other nameless poisons floated in the air, and the air itself stank of exhaustion, fatigue. Even the noises roaring up from the highway punished this dying air. The back end of a road sign reared like a gigantic television screen over his head. Jack wobbled to his feet. Far down the other side of the highway glinted an endless body of water, only slightly less gray than the sky. A sort of malignant luminescence darted across the surface. From here, too, rose an odor of metal filings and tired breath. Lake Ontario and the snug little city down there might be Olcott or Kendall. He'd gone miles out of his way, lost 100 miles or more in just about 4.5 days. Jack stepped under the sign, hoping it was no worse than that. He looked up at the black letters, wiped his mouth. Angola. Angola? Where was that? He peered down at the smoky little city through the already nearly tolerable air. And Rand McNally, that invaluable companion, told him that the acres of water way down there were Lake Erie. Instead of losing days of travel time, he had gained them. But before the boy could decide that he'd be smarter after all if he jumped back into the territories as soon as he thought it might be safe, which is to say as soon as Morgan's diligence had roared long past the place he had been, before he could do that, before he could even begin to think about doing that, he had to go down into the smoky little city of Angola and see if this time Jack Sawyer, Jacko, had played any of those changes, Daddy. He began to make his way down the slope, a 12-year-old boy in jeans and a plaid shirt, tall for his age, already beginning to look uncared for, with suddenly too much worry in his face. Halfway down the long slope, he realized that he was thinking in English again. Many days later, and a long way west, the man, Buddy Parkins by name, who just out of Cambridge, Ohio on U.S. 40, had picked up a tall boy calling himself Lewis Farron, would have recognized that look of worry. This kid Lewis looked like worry was about to sink into his face for good. "Lighten up, son, for your own sake, if no one else's," Buddy wanted to tell the boy. But the boy had enough troubles for 10, according to his story. Mother sick, father dead, sent off to some school teacher aunt in Buckeye Lake. Lewis Farron had plenty to trouble him. He looked as though he had not seen as much as $5 altogether since the previous Christmas. Still, Buddy thought that somewhere along the line, this Farron kid was jiving him. For one thing, he smelled like farm, not town. Buddy Parkins and his brothers ran 300 acres not far from Amanda, about 30 miles southeast of Columbus, and Buddy knew that he could not be wrong about this. The boys smelled like Cambridge, and Cambridge was country. Buddy had grown up with the smell of farmland and barnyard, of manure and growing corn and pea vineries, and the unwashed clothes of this boy beside him had absorbed all these familiar odors. And there were the clothes themselves. Mrs. Farron must have been awful sick, Buddy thought, if she sent her boy off down the road in ripped jeans so stiff with dirt the wrinkles seemed bronzed. And the shoes. Lewis Farron's sneakers were about to fall off his feet, the laces all spliced together, and the fabric split or worn through in a couple of places on each shoe. "So they got your daddy's car, did they, Lewis?" Buddy asked. "Just like I said, that's right. The lousy cowards came out after midnight and just stole it right out of the garage. I don't think they should be allowed to do that. Not from people who work hard and really are going to start making their payments as soon as they can. I mean, do you? You don't, do you?" The boy's honest, sunburned face was turned toward him as if this were the most serious question since the Nixon pardon, or maybe the Bay of Pigs. And all Buddy's instincts were to agree. He would be inclined to agree with any generally good-hearted opinion uttered by a boy so redolent of farm work. "I guess there's two sides to everything when you come down to it," Buddy Parkins said, not very happily. The boy blinked and then turned away to face forward again. Again, Buddy felt his anxiety, the cloud of worry that seemed to hang over the boy, and was almost sorry he had not given Lewis Farron the agreement he seemed to need. "I suppose your aunt's in the grade school there in Buckeye Lake," Buddy said, at least in part hoping to lighten the boy's misery, point to the future, not the past. "Yes, sir, that's right. She teaches in the grade school, Helen Vaughn." His expression did not change. But Buddy had heard it again. He didn't consider himself any Henry Higgins, the professor guy in that musical, but he knew for certain sure that young Lewis Farron didn't talk like anyone who had been raised in Ohio.
The kid's voice was all wrong, too pushed together and full of the wrong ups and downs. It wasn't an Ohio voice at all. It especially was not a rural Ohioan's voice. It was an accent. Or was it possible that some boy from Cambridge, Ohio, could learn to talk like that? Whatever his crazy reason might be. But he supposed it was. On the other hand, the newspaper, this Lewis Farron, had never once unclamped from beneath his left elbow, seemed to validate Buddy Parkin's deepest and worst suspicion that his fragrant young companion was a runaway and his every word a lie. The name of the paper, visible to Buddy with only the slightest tilt of his head, was the Angola Herald. There was that Angola in Africa that a lot of Englishmen had rushed off to as mercenaries, and there was Angola, New York, right up there on Lake Erie. He'd seen pictures of it on the news not long ago, but could not quite remember why. "I'd like to ask you a question, Lewis," he said and cleared his throat. "Yes," the boy said. "How come a boy from a nice little burg on U.S. 40 is carrying around a paper from Angola, New York? Which is one hell of a long way away. I'm just curious, son." The boy looked down at the paper flattened under his arm and hugged it even closer to him, as if he were afraid it might squirm away. "Oh," he said. "I found it." "Oh, hell," Buddy said. "Yes, sir. It was on a bench at the bus station back home." "You went to the bus station this morning?" "Right before I decided to save the money and hitch. Mr. Parkins, if you can get me to the turnoff at Zanesville, I'll only have a short ride left. Could probably get to my aunt's house before dinner."
"Could be," Buddy said, and drove in an uncomfortable silence for several miles. Finally, he could bear it no longer, and he said very quietly and while looking straight ahead, "Son, are you running away from home?" Lewis Farron astonished him by smiling. Not grinning and not faking it, but actually smiling. He thought the whole notion of running away from home was funny. It tickled him. The boy glanced at him a fraction of a second after Buddy had looked sideways, and their eyes met. For a second, for 2 seconds, three, for however long that moment lasted, Buddy Parkin saw that this unwashed boy sitting beside him was beautiful. He would have thought himself incapable of using that word to describe any male human being above the age of 9 months, but underneath the road grime, this Lewis Farron was beautiful. His sense of humor had momentarily murdered his worries, and what shone out of him at Buddy, who was 52 years old and had 3 teenage sons, was a kind of straightforward goodness that had only been dented by a host of unusual experiences. This Lewis Farron, 12 years old by his own account, had somehow gone farther and seen more than Buddy Parkins, and what he had seen and done had made him beautiful. "No, I'm not a runaway, Mr. Parkins," the boy said. Then he blinked, and his eyes went inward again and lost their brightness, their light, and the boy slumped back again against his seat. He pulled up a knee, rested it on the dashboard, and snugged the newspaper up under his bicep. "No, I guess not," Buddy Parkin said, snapping his eyes back to the highway. He felt relieved, though he was not quite sure why. "I guess you're not a runaway, Lewis. You're something, though." The boy did not respond. "Been working on a farm, haven't you?" Lewis looked up at him, surprised. "I did, yeah. The past 3 days, $2 an hour. And your mommy didn't even take the time out from being sick to wash her clothes before she sent you to her sister. Is that right?" Buddy thought. But what he said was, "Lewis, I'd like you to think about coming home with me. I'm not saying you're on the run or anything, but if you're from anywhere around Cambridge, I'll eat this beat-up old car, tires and all. And I got 3 boys myself, and the youngest one, Billy, he's only about 3 years older than you, and we know how to feed boys around my house. You can stay about as long as you like, depending on how many questions you want to answer, because I'll be asking them, at least after the first time we break bread together." He rubbed one palm over his gray crew cut and glanced across the seat. Lewis Farron was looking more like a boy and less like a revelation. "You'll be welcome, son." Smiling, the boy said, "That's really nice of you, Mr. Parkins, but I can't. I have to go see my aunt in Buckeye Lake," Buddy supplied. The boy swallowed and looked forward again.
I'll give you help if you want help, Buddy repeated.
Lewis patted his forearm, sunburned and thick. This ride is a big help, honest. 10 nearly silent minutes later, he was watching the boy's forlorn figure trudge down the exit ramp outside Zanesville. Emmy would probably have brained him if he'd come home with a strange, dirty boy to feed, but once she'd seen him and talked to him, Emmy would have brought out the good glasses and the plates her mother had given her. Buddy Parkins didn't believe that there was any woman named Helen Vaughn in Buckeye Lake, and he wasn't so sure this mysterious Lewis Farron even had a mother. The boy seemed such an orphan, off on a vast errand. Buddy watched until the boy was taken by the curve of the off-ramp, and he was staring out at space and the enormous yellow and purple sign of a shopping mall. For a second, he thought of jumping out of the car and running after the kid, trying to get him back. And then he had a moment of recall of a crowded, smoky scene on the 6 o'clock news. Angola, New York. Some disaster too small to be reported more than once. That was what had happened in Angola, one of those little tragedies the world shovels under a mountain of newsprint. All Buddy could catch in this short, probably flawed moment of memory was a picture of girders strewn like giant straws over battered cars jutting up out of a fuming hole in the ground, a hole that might lead down into hell. Buddy Parkins looked once more at the empty place on the road where the boy had been, and then stamped on his clutch and dropped the old car into low. Buddy Parkins' memory was more accurate than he imagined. If he could have seen the first page of the month-old Angola Herald, Lewis Farron, that enigmatic boy had been holding so protectively yet fearfully beneath his arm, these are the words he would have read. Freak earthquake kills five, by Herald staff reporter Joseph Gargan. Work on the Rainbird Towers, intended to be Angola's tallest and most luxurious condominium development, and still 6 months from completion, was tragically halted yesterday as an unprecedented earth tremor collapsed the structure of the building, burying many construction workers beneath the rubble. Five bodies have been retrieved from the ruins of the proposed condominium, and two other workers have not yet been found, but are presumed dead. All seven workers were welders and fitters in the employ of Spicer Construction, and all were on the girders of the building's top two floors at the time of the incident. Yesterday's tremor was the first earthquake in Angola's recorded history. Armin Van Pelt of New York University's Geology Department, contacted today by telephone, described the fatal quake as a seismic bubble. Representatives of the State Safety Commission are continuing their examinations of the site, as is a team of... The dead men were Robert Heidel, 23, Thomas Thielke, 34, Jerome Wild, 48, Michael Hagen, 29, and Bruce Davey, 39. The two men still missing were Arnold Schulkamp, 54, and Theodore Rasmussen, 43. Jack no longer had to look at the newspaper's front page to remember their names. The first earthquake in the history of Angola, New York, had occurred on the day he had flipped away from the western road and landed on the town's border. Part of Jack Sawyer wished that he could have gone home with big, kindly Buddy Parkins, eaten dinner around the table in the kitchen with the Parkins family, boiled beef and deep-dish apple pie, and then snuggled into the Parkins' guest bed and pulled the homemade quilt up over his head. And not moved except toward the table for 4 or 5 days. But part of the trouble was that he saw that knotty pine kitchen table heaped with crumbly cheese, and on the other side of the table a mouse hole was cut into a giant baseboard, and from holes in the jeans of the three Parkins boys protruded thin, long tails. "Who plays these Jerry Bledsoe changes, Daddy? Heidel, Thielke, Wild, Hagen, Davey, Schulkamp, and Rasmussen. Those Jerry changes." He knew who played them. The huge yellow and purple sign reading Buckeye Mall floated ahead of Jack as he came around the final curve of the off-ramp, drifted past his shoulder, and reappeared on his other side. At which point he could finally see that it was erected on a tripod of tall yellow poles in the shopping center parking lot.
The mall itself was a futuristic assemblage of ochre-colored buildings that seemed to be windowless. A second later, Jack realized that the mall was covered, and what he was seeing was only the illusion of separate buildings. He put his hand in his pocket and fingered the tight roll of 23 single-dollar bills, which was his earthly fortune. In the cool sunlight of an early autumn afternoon, Jack sprinted across the street toward the mall's parking lot. If it had not been for his conversation with Buddy Parkins, Jack would very likely have stayed on U.S. 40 and tried to cover another 50 miles. He wanted to get to Illinois, where Richard Sloat was, in the next 2 or 3 days. The thought of seeing his friend Richard again had kept him going during the weary days of non-stop work on Albert Palamountain's farm. The image of spectacled, serious-faced Richard Sloat in his room at Thayer School in Springfield, Illinois, had fueled him as much as Mrs. Palamountain's generous meals. Jack still wanted to see Richard, and as soon as he could, but Buddy Parkins inviting him home had somehow unstrung him. He could not just climb into another car and begin all over again on the story. In any case, Jack reminded himself, the story seemed to be losing its potency. The shopping mall gave him a perfect chance to drop out for an hour or two, especially if there was a movie theater somewhere in there. Right now, Jack could have watched the dullest, soppiest love story of a movie. And before the movie, were he lucky enough to find a theater, he would be able to take care of 2 things he had been putting off for at least a week. Jack had seen Buddy Parkins looking at his disintegrating Nikes. Not only were the running shoes falling apart, the soles, once spongy and elastic, had mysteriously become hard as asphalt. On days when he had to walk great distances, or when he had to work standing up all day, his feet stung as if they'd been burned. The second task, calling his mother, was so loaded with guilt and other fearful emotions that Jack could not quite allow it to become conscious. He did not know if he could keep from weeping once he'd heard his mother's voice. What if she sounded weak? What if she sounded really sick? Could he really keep going west if Lily hoarsely begged him to come back to New Hampshire? So he could not admit to himself that he was probably going to call his mother. His mind gave him the suddenly very clear image of a bank of pay telephones beneath their hair dryer plastic bubbles and almost immediately backed away from it, as if Elroy or some other territory's creature could reach right out of the receiver and clamp a hand around his throat. Just then, 3 girls, a year or two older than Jack, bounced out of the back of a Subaru Brat which had swung recklessly into a parking spot near the mall's main entrance. For a second, they had the look of models contorted into awkwardly elegant poses of delight and astonishment. When they had adjusted into more conventional postures, the girls glanced incuriously at Jack and began to flip their hair expertly back into place. They were leggy in their tight jeans, these confident little princesses of the 10th grade, and when they laughed, they put their hands over their mouths in a fashion which suggested that laughter itself was laughable. Jack slowed his walk into a kind of sleepwalker's stroll. One of the princesses glanced at him and muttered something to the brown-haired girl beside her. "I'm different now," Jack thought. "I'm not like them anymore." The recognition pierced him with loneliness. A thick-set blonde boy in a blue sleeveless down vest climbed out of the driver's seat and gathered the girls around him by the simple expedient of pretending to ignore them. The boy, who must have been a senior and at the very least in the varsity backfield, glanced once at Jack and then looked appraisingly at the facade of the mall. "Timmy," said the tall brown-haired girl. "Yeah, yeah," the boy said. "I was just wondering what smells like shit out here." He rewarded the girls with a superior little smile. The brown-haired girl looked smirkingly toward Jack, then swung herself across the asphalt with her friends. The 3 girls followed Timmy's arrogant body through the glass doors into the mall. Jack waited until the figures of Timmy and his court, visible through the glass, had shrunk to the size of puppies far down the long mall before he stepped on the plate which opened the doors. Cold, pre-digested air embraced him. Water trickled down over a fountain 2 stories high, set in a wide pool surrounded by benches. Open-fronted shops on both levels faced the fountain. Bland muzak drifted down from the ochre ceiling, as did the peculiar bronzy light. The smell of popcorn, which had struck Jack the moment the glass doors had whooshed shut behind him, emanated from an antique popcorn wagon, painted fire engine red, and stationed outside a Walden Books to the left of the fountain on the ground level. Jack had seen immediately that there was no movie theater in the Buckeye Mall. Timmy and his leggy princesses were floating up the escalator at the mall's other end, making, Jack thought, for a fast food restaurant called the Captain's Table, right at the top of the escalator. Jack put his hand in his pants pocket again and touched his roll of bills. Speedy's guitar pick and Captain Farron's coin nested at the bottom of the pocket, along with a handful of dimes and quarters. On Jack's level, sandwiched between a Mr. Chip's cookie shop and a liquor store advertising new low prices for Hiram Walker Bourbon and Inglenook Chablis, a Fava shoe store drew him toward its long table of running shoes. The clerk at the cash register leaned forward and watched Jack pick over the shoes, clearly suspicious that he might try to steal something. Jack recognized none of the brands on the table. There were no Nikes or Pumas here. They were called Speedster or Bullseye or Zooms, and the laces of each pair were tied together. These were sneakers, not true running shoes. They were good enough, Jack supposed. He bought the cheapest pair the store had in his size, blue canvas with red zigzag stripes down the sides. No brand name was visible anywhere on the shoes. They seemed indistinguishable from most of the other shoes on the table. At the register, he counted out 6 limp $1 bills and told the clerk that he did not need a bag. Jack sat on one of the benches before the tall fountain and towed off the battered Nikes without bothering to unlace them. When he slipped on the new sneakers, his feet fairly sighed with gratitude. Jack left the bench and dropped his old shoes in a tall black wastebasket with "Don't Be a Litter Bug" stenciled on it in white. Beneath that, in smaller letters, the wastebasket read, "The Earth is our only home." Jack began to move aimlessly through the long lower arcade of the mall, searching for the telephones. At the popcorn wagon, he parted with 50 cents and was handed a quart-sized tub of fresh popcorn glistening with grease. The middle-aged man in a bowler hat, a walrus mustache, and sleeve garters who sold him the popcorn told him that the payphones were around a corner next to 31 Flavors upstairs. The man gestured vaguely toward the nearest escalator. Scooping the popcorn into his mouth, Jack rode up behind a woman in her 20s and an older woman with hips so wide they nearly covered the entire width of the escalator, both of them in pantsuits. If Jack were to flip inside the Buckeye Mall, or even a mile or two from it, would the walls shake and the ceiling crumble down, dropping bricks and beams and muzak speakers and light fixtures down on everybody unlucky enough to be inside? And would the 10th grade princesses and even arrogant Timmy and most of the others, too, wind up with skull fractures and severed limbs and mangled chests and... For a second, just before he reached the top of the escalator, Jack saw giant chunks of plaster and metal girders showering down, heard the terrible cracking of the mezzanine floor, the screams, too, inaudible, they were still printed in the air. Angola. The Rainbird Towers. Jack felt his palms begin to itch and sweat, and he wiped them on his jeans. 31 Flavors gleamed out a chilly, incandescent white light to his left, and when he turned that way, he saw a curving hallway on its other side. Shiny brown tiles on the walls and floor. As soon as the curve of the hallway took him out of sight of anyone on the mezzanine level, Jack saw 3 telephones, which were indeed under transparent plastic bubbles. Across the hall from the telephones were doors to men and ladies. Beneath the middle bubble, Jack dialed 0, followed by the area code and the number for the Alhambra Inn and Gardens. "Billing?" asked the operator, and Jack said, "This is a collect call for Mrs. Sawyer in 407 and 408 from Jack." The hotel operator answered, and Jack's chest tightened. She transferred the call to the suite. The telephone rang once, twice, three times. Then his mother said, "Jesus, kid, I'm glad to hear from you. This absentee mother business is hard on an old girl like me. I kind of miss you when you're not moping around and telling me how to act with waiters." "You're just too classy for most waiters, that's all," Jack said, and thought that he might begin to cry with relief. "Are you all right, Jack? Tell me the truth."
"I'm fine, sure," he said. "Yeah, I'm fine. I just had to make sure that you know."
The phone whispered electronically, a skirl of static that sounded like sand blowing across a beach.
"I'm okay," Lily said. "I'm great. I'm not any worse, anyhow, if that's what you're worried about. I suppose I'd like to know where you are."
Jack paused, and the static whispered and hissed for a moment.
"I'm in Ohio now. Pretty soon I'm going to be able to see Richard."
"When are you coming home, Jacko?"
"I can't say. I wish I could."
"You can't say.
I swear, kid. If your father hadn't called you that silly name, and if you'd asked me about this 10 minutes earlier or 10 minutes later..."
A rising tide of static took her voice, and Jack remembered how she'd looked in the tea shop, haggard and feeble, an old woman. When the static receded, he asked, "Are you having any trouble with Uncle Morgan? Is he bothering you?"
"I sent your Uncle Morgan away from here with a flea in his ear," she said.
"He was there? He did come? Is he still bothering you?"
"I got rid of the stoat about 2 days after you left, baby. Don't waste time worrying about him."
"Did he say where he was going?" Jack asked her, but as soon as the words were out of his mouth, the telephone uttered a tortured electronic squeal that seemed to bore right into his head. Jack grimaced and jerked the receiver away from his ear. The awful whining noise of static was so loud that anyone stepping into the corridor would have heard it.
"Mom!"
Jack shouted, putting the phone as close to his head as he dared. The squeal of static increased, as if a radio between stations had been turned up to full volume. The line abruptly fell silent. Jack clamped the receiver to his ear and heard only the flat black silence of dead air.
"Hey,"
he said, and jiggled the hook. The flat silence in the phone seemed to press up against his ear. Just as abruptly, and as if his jiggling the hook had caused it, the dial tone, an oasis of sanity, of regularity now, resumed. Jack jammed his right hand in his pocket, looking for another coin. He was holding the receiver, awkwardly, in his left hand as he dug in his pocket. He froze when he heard the dial tone suddenly slot off into outer space. Morgan Sloat's voice spoke to him as clearly as if good old Uncle Morgan were standing at the next telephone.
"Get your ass back home, Jack."
Sloat's voice carved the air like a scalpel.
"You just get your ass back home before we have to take you back ourselves."
"Wait,"
Jack said, as if he were begging for time. In fact, he was too terrified to know quite what he was saying.
"Can't wait any longer, little pal. You're a murderer now."
"That's right, isn't it? You're a murderer.
So we're not able to give you any more chances. You just get your can back to that resort in New Hampshire, now. Or maybe you'll go home in a bag."
Jack heard the click of the receiver. He dropped it. The telephone Jack had used shuddered forward, then sagged off the wall. For a second it drooped on a network of wires, then crashed heavily to the floor. The door to the men's room banged open behind Jack, and a voice yelled, "Holy shit!" Jack turned to see a thin, crew-cut boy of about 20 staring at the telephones. He was wearing a white apron and a bow tie, a clerk at one of the shops.
"I didn't do it," Jack said. "It just happened."
"Holy shit!"
The crew-cut clerk goggled at Jack for a split second, jerked as if to run, and then ran his hands over the crown of his head. Jack backed away down the hall. When he was halfway down the escalator, he finally heard the clerk yelling, "Mr. Olofsson, the phone! Mr. Olofsson!" Jack fled. Outside, the air was bright, surprisingly humid. Dazed, Jack wandered across the sidewalk. A half mile away across the parking lot, a black and white police car swung in toward the mall. Jack turned sideways and began to walk down the pavement. Some way ahead, a family of six struggled to get a lawn chair in through the next entrance to the mall. Jack slowed down and watched the husband and wife tilt the long chair diagonally, hindered by the attempts of the smaller children to either sit on the chair or to assist them. At last, nearly in the posture of the flag raisers in the famous photograph of Iwo Jima, the family staggered through the door. The police car lazily circled through the big parking lot. Just past the door where the disorderly family had succeeded in planting their chair, an old black man sat on a wooden crate, cradling a guitar in his lap. As Jack slowly drew nearer, he saw the metal cup beside the man's feet. The man's face was hidden behind big, dirty sunglasses and beneath the brim of a stained felt hat. The sleeves of his denim jacket were as wrinkled as an elephant's hide. Jack swerved out to the edge of the pavement to give the man all the room he seemed to warrant, and noticed that around the man's neck hung a sign, handwritten in big, shaky capital letters on discolored white cardboard. A few steps later, he could read the letters. "Blind since birth. Will play any song. God bless you." He had nearly walked past the man holding the beat-up old guitar when he heard him utter, his voice a cracked and juicy whisper, "Yeah, Bob." Chapter 15. Snowball Sings. Jack swung back toward the black man, his heart hammering in his chest. "Speedy?" The black man groped for his cup, held it up, shook it. A few coins rattled in the bottom. "It is Speedy. Behind those dark glasses, it is Speedy." Jack was sure of it. But a moment later, he was just as sure that it wasn't Speedy. Speedy wasn't built square in the shoulders and broad across the chest. Speedy's shoulders were rounded, a little slumped over, and his chest consequently had a slightly caved-in look. Mississippi John Hurt, not Ray Charles. But I could tell one way or the other for sure if he'd take off those shades. He opened his mouth to speak Speedy's name aloud, and suddenly the old man began to play, his wrinkled fingers as dully dark as old walnut that has been faithfully oiled but never polished, moving with limber speed and grace on both strings and frets. He played well, finger-picking the melody, and after a moment Jack recognized the tune. It had been on one of his father's older records, a Vanguard album called Mississippi John Hurt Today. And although the blind man didn't sing, Jack knew the words. "Oh, kindly friends, tell me ain't it hard to see old Lewis in a new graveyard. The angels laid him away." The blonde football player and his three princesses came out of the mall's main doors. Each of the princesses had an ice cream cone. Mr. All-America had a chili dog in each hand. They sauntered toward where Jack stood. Jack, whose whole attention was taken up by the old black man, had not even noticed them. He had been transfixed by the idea that it was Speedy, and Speedy had somehow read his mind. How else could it be that this man had begun to play a Mississippi John Hurt composition just as Jack happened to think Speedy looked like that very man, and a song containing his own road name as well? The blonde football player transferred both chili dogs to his left hand and slapped Jack on the back with his right as hard as he could. Jack's teeth snapped on his own tongue like a bear trap. The pain was sudden and excruciating. "You just shake her easy, urine breath," he said. The princesses giggled and shrieked. Jack stumbled forward and kicked over the blind man's cup. Coins spilled and rolled. The gentle lilt of the blues tune came to a jangling halt. Mr. All-America and the three little princesses were already moving on. Jack stared after them and felt the now familiar, impotent hate. This was how it felt to be on your own, just young enough to be at everyone's mercy and to be anyone's meat, anyone from a psychotic like Osmond to a humorless old Lutheran like Albert Palamon, whose idea of a pretty fair workday was to slog and squelch through gluey fields for 12 hours during a steady, cold downpour of October rain, and to sit bolt upright in the cab of his International Harvester truck during lunch hour, eating onion sandwiches and reading from the Book of Job. Jack had no urge to get them, although he had a strange idea that if he wanted to, he could. That he was gaining some sort of power, almost like an electrical charge. It sometimes seemed to him that other people knew that, too, that it was in their faces when they looked at him. But he didn't want to get them, he only wanted to be left alone. The blind man was feeling around himself for the spilled money, his pudgy hands moving gently over the pavement, almost seeming to read it. He happened on a dime, set his cup back up again, and dropped the dime in. Plink! Faintly, Jack heard one of the princesses. Why do they let him stay there? He's so gross, you know. Even more faintly still. Yeah, really. Jack got down on his knees and began to help, picking up coins and putting them into the blind man's cup. Down here, close to the old man, he could smell sour sweat, mildew, and some sweet, bland smell like corn. Smartly dressed mall shoppers gave them a wide berth.
Thank you, thank you, the blind man croaked monotonously.
Jack could smell dead chili on his breath.
Thank you, bless you, God bless you, thank you.
He is speedy. He's not speedy. What finally forced him to speak, and this was not really so odd, was remembering just how little of the magic juice he had left. Barely two swallows now. He did not know if after what had happened in Angola he could ever bring himself to travel in the territories again, but he was still determined to save his mother's life, and that meant he might have to. And whatever the talisman was, he might have to flip into the other world to get it.
Speedy? Bless you, thank you, God bless you, didn't I hear one go over there?
He pointed.
Speedy, it's Jack. Ain't nothing speedy around here, boy, no sir.
His hands began to whisper walk along the concrete in the direction he had just pointed. One of them found a nickel and he dropped it into the cup. His other happened to touch the shoe of a smartly dressed young woman who was passing by. Her pretty, empty face wrinkled in almost painful disgust as she drew away from him. Jack picked the last coin out of the gutter. It was a silver dollar, a big old cartwheel with Lady Liberty on one side. Tears began to spill out of his eyes. They ran down his dirty face, and he wiped them away with an arm that shook. He was crying for Thielke, Wilde, Hagen, Davy, and Heidel, for his mother, for Laura Deloessian, for the Carter's son lying dead in the road with his pockets turned out. But most of all, for himself. He was tired of being on the road. Maybe when you rode it in a Cadillac, it was a road of dreams, but when you had to hitch it, riding on your thumb in a story that was just about worn out, when you were at everybody's mercy and anyone's meat, it was nothing but a road of trials. Jack felt that he had been tried enough, but there was no way to cry it off. If he cried it off, the cancer would take his mother, and Uncle Morgan might well take him.
I don't think I can do it, Speedy, he wept. I don't think so, man.
Now the blind man groped for Jack instead of the spilled coins. Those gentle, weeding fingers found his arm and closed around it. Jack could feel the hard pad of callus in the tip of each finger. He drew Jack to him into those odors of sweat and heat and old chili. Jack pressed his face against Speedy's chest.
Ooh, boy, I don't know no Speedy, but it sound like you putting an awful lot on him.
I miss my mom, Speedy, Jack wept, and Sloat's after me. It was him on the phone inside the mall, him. And that's not the worst thing. The worst thing was in Angola, the Rainbird Towers. Earthquake. Five men. Me. I did it, Speedy. I killed those men when I flipped into this world. I killed them just like my dad and Morgan Sloat killed Jerry Bledsoe that time.
Now it was out. The worst of it. He had sicked up the stone of guilt that had been in his throat threatening to choke him, and a storm of weeping seized him. But this time it was relief rather than fear. It was said. It had been confessed. He was a murderer.
Hoo-wee!
The black man cried. He sounded perversely delighted. He held Jack with one thin, strong arm, rocked him.
You trying to carry you one heavy load, boy. You sure am. Maybe you ought to put some of it down.
I killed him, Jack whispered. Thielke, Wild, Hagen, David.
Well, if your friend Speedy was here, the black man said, whoever he might be or wherever he might be in this wide old world, he might tell you that you can't carry the world on your shoulders, son. You can't do that. No one can. Try to carry the world on your shoulders, why, first it's gonna break your back, and then it's gonna break your spirit.
I killed, put a gun to their heads and shot somebody, did you?
No, the earthquake. I flipped
on, no, nothing about that, the black man said.
Jack had pulled away from him a bit and was staring up into the black man's seamed face with wondering curiosity. But the black man had turned his head toward the parking lot. If he was blind, then he had picked out the smoother, slightly more powerful beat of the police car's engine from the others as it approached, because he was looking right at it.
All I know is you seem to have this idea of murder a little broad. Probably if some fella dropped dead of a heart attack going round us as we sit here, you'd think you killed him. Oh, look, I done murdered that fella on account of where I was sitting. Oh, whoa, oh, doom, oh, gloom, oh, this, oh, that.
As he spoke this and that, the blind man punctuated it with a quick change from G to C and back to G again. He laughed, pleased with himself.
Speedy, nothing speedy around here, the black man reiterated, and then showed yellow teeth in a crooked grin.
Said maybe how speedy some folks are to put the blame on themselves for things others might have got started. Maybe you were running, boy, and maybe you being chased.
G chord.
Maybe you just be a little off base.
C chord with a nifty little run in the middle that made Jack grin in spite of himself.
Might be somebody else getting on your case.
Back down to G again, and the blind man laid his guitar aside, while in the police car the two cops were flipping to see which of them would actually have to touch old Snowball if he wouldn't get into the back of the cruiser peaceably.
Maybe doom and maybe gloom, and maybe this and maybe that.
He laughed again, as if Jack's fears were the funniest thing he'd ever heard.
But I don't know what could happen if I... No one ever knows what could happen if they do anything, do they?
The black man, who might or might not be Speedy Parker, broke in.
No, they do not. If you thought about it, you'd stay in your house all day, as scared to come out. I don't know your problems, boy. Don't want to know them. Could be crazy, talking about earthquakes and all. But being as how you helped me pick up my money and didn't steal none, I counted every plinkety-plink, so I know. I give you some advice. Some things you can't help. Sometimes people get killed because somebody does something, but if somebody didn't do that something, a whole lot of more people would have got killed. You see why I'm pushing, son?
The dirty sunglasses inclined down toward him. Jack felt a deep, shuddery relief. He saw all right. The blind man was talking about hard choices. He was suggesting that maybe there was a difference between hard choices and criminal behavior, and that maybe the criminal wasn't here. The criminal might have been the guy who had told him 5 minutes ago to get his ass home.
Could even be, the blind man remarked, hitting a dark D minor chord on his box, that all things serve the Lord, just like my mama told me and your mama might have told you if she was a Christian lady. Could be we think we're doing one thing, but are really doing another. Good book says all things, even those that seem evil, serve the Lord. What you think, boy?
I don't know, Jack said honestly.
He was all mixed up. He only had to close his eyes, and he could see the telephone tearing off the wall, hanging from its wires like a weird puppet.
Well, it smells like you letting it drive you to drink.
What?
Jack asked, astonished. Then he thought, I thought that Speedy looked like Mississippi John Hurt, and this guy started playing a John Hurt blues, and now he's talking about the magic juice. He's being careful, but I swear that's what he's talking about. It's got to be.
You're a mind reader, Jack said in a low voice. Aren't you? Did you learn it in the territory, Speedy?
Don't know nothing about reading minds, the blind man said. But my lamps have been out 42 years come November, and in 42 years your nose and ears take up some of the slack. I can smell cheap wine on you, son, smell it all over you. It's almost like you washed your hair with it.
Jack felt an odd, dreamy guilt. It was the way he always felt when accused of doing something wrong when he was in fact innocent. Mostly innocent, anyway. He had done no more than touch the almost empty bottle since flipping back into this world. Just touching it filled him with dread. He had come to feel about it the way a 14th-century European peasant might have felt about a splinter of the one true cross or the finger bone of a saint. It was magic, all right, powerful magic, and sometimes it got people killed. "I haven't been drinking it, honest," he finally managed. "What I started with is almost gone. I don't even like it." His stomach had begun to clench nervously. Just thinking about the magic juice was making him feel nauseated. "But I need to get some more, just in case."
"More purple Jesus? Boy your age?"
The blind man laughed and made a shooing gesture with one hand.
"Hell, you don't need that. No boy needs that poison to travel with."
"But
here, I'll sing you a song to cheer you up. Sounds like you could use it."
He began to sing, and his singing voice was nothing at all like his speaking voice. It was deep and powerful and thrilling, without the nigger Jim, "My hook that sure is gay," cadences of his talk. It was, Jack thought, odd, almost the trained, cultured voice of an opera singer, now amusing itself with a little piece of popular fluff. Jack felt goosebumps rise on his arms and back at that rich, full voice. Along the sidewalk which ran along the dull ochre flank of the mall, heads turned. "When the red, red robin goes bob, bob, bobbin' along, along, there'll be no more sobbin' when he starts throbbin' his old sweet song." Jack was struck by a sweet and terrible familiarity, a sense that he had heard this before, or something very like it, and as the blind man bridged, grinning his crooked, yellowing smile, Jack realized where the feeling was coming from. He knew what had made all those heads turn, as they would have turned if a unicorn had gone galloping across the mall's parking lot. There was a beautiful, alien clarity in the man's voice. It was the clarity of, say, air so pure that you could smell a radish when a man pulled one out of the ground half a mile away. It was a good old Tin Pan Alley song, but the voice was pure territories. "Get up, get up, you sleepyhead, get out, get out, get out of bed, live, love, laugh, and be happy." Both guitar and voice came to a sudden halt. Jack, who had been concentrating fiercely on the blind man's face, trying subconsciously to peer right through those dark glasses, perhaps, and see if Speedy Parker's eyes were behind them, now widened his focus and saw two cops standing beside the blind man.
"You know, I don't hear nothing,"
the blind guitarist said, almost coyly.
"But I believe I smell something blue."
"God damn it, Snowball, you know you're not supposed to work the mall," one of the cops cried. "What did Judge Hallis tell you the last time he had you in chambers? Downtown, between Center Street and Mural Street. No place else. Damn, boy, how senile have you got? Your pecker rotted off yet from that what-all your woman gave you before she took off? Christ, I just don't..." His partner put a hand on his arm and nodded toward Jack in a little pitchers have big ears gesture. "Go tell your mother she wants you, kid," the first cop said curtly. Jack started walking down the sidewalk. He couldn't stay. Even if there was something he could do, he couldn't stay. He was lucky the cop's attention had been taken up by the man they called Snowball. If they'd given him a second chance, Jack had no doubt he would have been asked to produce his bona fides. New sneakers or not, the rest of him looked used and battered. It doesn't take cops long to get good at spotting road kids, and Jack was a boy on the road if there ever had been one. He imagined being tossed into the Zanesville pokey while the Zanesville cops, fine upstanding boys in blue who listened to Paul Harvey every day and supported President Reagan, tried to find out whose little boy he was. No, he didn't want the Zanesville cops giving him more than the one passing glance. A motor throbbing smoothly coming up behind him. Jack hunched his pack a little higher on his back and looked down at his new sneakers as if they interested him tremendously. From the corners of his eyes, he saw the police cruiser slide slowly by. The blind man was in the back seat, the neck of his guitar poking up beside him.
As the cruiser swung into one of the outbound lanes, the blind man abruptly turned his head and looked out the back window. Looked directly at Jack. And although Jack could not see through the dirty, dark glasses, he knew perfectly well that Lester Speedy Parker had winked at him.